For May the 3rd, we do a bonus level about Spec Ops The Line, featuring an interview with lead level designer Jörg Friedrich. Welcome to the bonus level. My name is Cole Ross.
I'm Dennis Furia.
I'm David Moneysmith.
And I'm Gary Butterfield.
And I'm Ben Merkel.
And you're listening to The Level, a podcast for people who love video games. And this is a very special bonus level of our program, dedicated entirely to Spec Ops The Line, a game which was developed by Jaeger Games and published by 2K. Last year, I think, something like that, third-person shooter. Tremendously important, we feel, enough that we all played through it again, and or some of us for the first time, we want to kind of dive in deep. This is unusual. If this is the first time you're listening to us, normally we're kind of a general-purpose game news, what you've been playing. I like to think of it as an audio periodical or a periodical. A-U-D-I-C-A-L.
Yeah. Shut up, Cole.
but this one's a little bit different. It's more of a game club kind of thing. We're going to be focusing entirely on one game. You should know right away that we're going to spoil the shit out of this game. But the good news is, if you haven't played it yet, you can go and pick it up for real cheap on most systems. It's very short. And it's definitely worth playing. I think that everybody here would agree. I think we're burying the lead here, though, because the biggest treat is we have an interview that we're going to play at the top here with the lead level designer on Spec Ops and now a lead designer with Jaeger named Jörg Friedrich, who was so kind to accommodate us and, hop on to kind of talk about the development of the game and the general themes. And we think it was pretty good, and we really, really hope you appreciate it. So we're going to play that. It's going to go for a little while, and when we come back, we're going to dive into kind of our impressions and experiences with the game. Did I miss anything there, fellas?
No, you got to segue into it, though.
Oh, okay. So, hey, Jörg, you're not here right now, but this is a flashback. Something I don't know. Let's go.
I think our story should be that we magically turn Gary into Jörg.
Okay. Yes, Gary.
Oh, he's going all Agent Smith.
I can hear his bones popping. Hey, Gary. Wow.
Well, thanks, Cole, for that perfect segue into the interview. You've outdone yourself this time. Ladies and gentlemen, let's say a big welcome to Jörg Friedrich, who's joining us from Jaeger. Jörg, thank you so much for being with us.
I'm very happy to be with you. When you guys contacted me, I listened a little bit to your podcast, and I have to say I really like it. I like your approach. It's a cool thing.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I'm glad to hear that.
Thank you.
And we're just as big a fan of your work. Jörg is the and tell me if I'm capturing your role correctly, but the lead level designer for Jaeger development.
I used to be the lead level designer on Spec Ops. I'm now the lead designer on an unannounced new project.
Okay, very cool. Well, Spec Ops is what we're talking about today.
Yes, and,
congratulations.
Yeah. And just by way of introduction, why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself, and then tell us a little bit about your role as lead level designer on Spec Ops?
Yeah, I'm happy to. Well, I'm in the industry since around about 2003, so around about 10 years now. I worked on different titles, mainly smaller ones originally. Most of them are mainly known in Germany. Germany was famous for its PC market, so usually if you wanted to get into the industry in Germany, you end up in a studio doing a PC game. So I did that. I worked as on my first job already, I became a lead level designer. It was a game called Desperados 2, which was a Western Commandos, if you want, if anyone remembers that. It was a 2D tactical game. Yeah, something similar to that. Then I worked on a role-playing game, which was called Drakensang. And eventually, I ended up at Jaeger in 2007. That was pretty much when they started working on Spec Ops. That I came in there in the beginning. I always jumped between level design and game design. I love both disciplines, and I became my first role on Spec Ops was actually the AI designer, and I designed a lot of the, you know, squad AI and so Lugo and Adams and how they behave and the enemies, different enemy types, stuff like this. And eventually I grew into the lead level designer role, which was super amazing and interesting on that kind of project.
Right. That's awesome. One of the things I love about the AI is the chatter that goes along with it. Yeah. Did you have a role in creating that?
Yes. Well, we all did. I mean, there was a designer who mainly took care of that. There was the AI design part of that was basically defining on, you know, when do they say something, like defining different events, like, oh my god, I get hit, oh my god, I get flanked, I get I'm desperate, all this stuff, and then that got transferred into fitting lines, so to speak. Yeah, that was lots of fun. As you can, we did a lot of a lot with voice very early on in the production already. We did a lot of developer recordings, which was a lot of fun as well. One of the most amazing details is still that Corey Davis, our lead designer on Spec Ops, he loved to play actually Walker. And yes, and he got a super impressive voice, and he was really, really good at yelling. You know, I don't know if you ever big dude, he was like really good at yelling and like, oh, I'm getting super desperate and getting super into it. And the fantastic part was we gave that later, our developer recordings, also to the actors, to Nolan North and that. Yeah. In that case, right, who speaks the role of Walker.
Yes.
And, dude, Nolan North sounds like Corey. There was a voice in the beginning when we got the voice recordings back, and I had to check the levels and play them in the reviews, and I said, hey, there's still Corey's voice in there. no, that's Nolan North. yeah, that was very interesting and lots of fun.
You should have just kept Corey's voice and saved some money.
nothing against Nolan North. He did an amazing job, especially in the development of the character, like how he changes. I think in the beginning he has still this kind of a little bit Nathan Drake-ish thing. You can clearly tell that Nolan North, right? You've heard them before in other games, but in the end, it's like, well, I think it's outstanding. It's really, his performance is super awesome. Yeah, we're very happy with that. With actually all the voice actors, they were really good.
Nice.
Yeah.
His voice almost gets primal towards the end of the game.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. You can really tell. And he had a lot of fun as well at the recordings. You could tell that he could, you know, do something different this time and go really crazy and over the edge and yell like shit.
Definitely.
All right. Well, I think that kind of leads into one of the questions I had. I wanted to know about, I wondered if you could tell us about the initial development of the game and if you had any goals early on when making the game that you wanted to accomplish.
Well, probably no, is the whole development, like including early concept phase and pre-production, took 5 years. So that was long ride. And as in most games which take that long, there were changes and stuff that developed over time. And so as we started out at Jaeger, the whole relationship to 2K started with Jaeger pitching a third-person cover-based sci-fi game to 2K. called Vertical War. And we actually, I need to insist on that, we did have a cover system before Gears of War released. I mean, Gears of War wasn't either, but we actually had it prototyped already. It looked really good. It was lots of fun to play already. It had all the stuff you expect, your blind fire and all these features.
Right.
And hence the name Vertical War. It was a lot about verticality and vertical gameplay in a dystopian science fiction world, kind of a desperate city. And 2K really liked the prototype. They really liked the pitch. They liked us, basically. Jaeger was a very small team back then, but very, very talented and ambitious people. And yeah, but 2K took a look at that and said, we like the game. We actually like the gameplay. We like to do something with you. But we have this brand which we want to reboot, which is called Spec Ops. And that was before Modern Warfare 1 shipped. As I said, it was a long development time. So they said, yeah, but we, our contacts say military shooter, modern military shooter, gonna be a big thing soon. So we want to reboot that brand. Can you pitch something to us? And then there was the team was pretty small at that point. We were like 30 people, and so everything was very. Very private, and like everybody was involved and could put out ideas, and there was a lot of brainstorming going on. And one of the earliest ideas was it should play in Dubai.
Really?
First milestones, yes. Mainly because our art director Matthias, he was looking for something impressive and opulent and something, like big, huge. He loves that stuff. And big buildings and something really, impressive. And also it shouldn't be something we decided also on very early was we didn't want to go in a realistic scenario. We didn't want, we didn't want to go to Iraq or something like that. We wanted to have something which is fictional, intentionally. And so Dubai sounded like a cool idea, and then there was this idea floating around very early. A lot of people on the team liked Apocalypse Now or The Heart of Darkness.
Yes. So
we thought, hey, couldn't we make that into a military shooter? Wouldn't that be cool? And we were really not sure if 2K would buy that because it's kind of controversial, but it was kind of the opposite. Actually, we pitched that idea about an Apocalypse Now shooter, and the guy in charge at 2K basically said, well, that sounds cool. That sounds like something 2K would like to develop, but you guys are aware that this is going to make a different game, a very different game. You're going to make the player feel bad to make that, to get that point. We're like, we don't know. So it's actually really we were running in open doors at 2K, and they were super supportive on that, which was awesome. And then this collaboration happened. And then, one thing comes to the other. You want to do an Apocalypse Now game or like loosely based on that theme. But nowadays we wanted to have certain cornerstones like, yes, there's this lost or deserted kind of area where someone could take power and be in charge all alone and suppress the people there and make up his own rules and stuff like this. So I can't tell when the idea came in or how exactly, but since we like Dubai as a setting, and Dubai is in the desert, so like, hey, how about the city is separated from the rest of the world because a giant sandstorm changed everything. Right. And that was an amazing idea and scenario for the artists. So we did a very early prototype of the sandstorm back then. which was very impressive, and everybody was super happy about that. And we said, hey, that's cool. Let's go with this. Let's do this. And yeah, that's how it started.
Awesome. Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah. So the game has really memorable set pieces and very memorable choices. And I'm kind of wondering how you guys approached putting those together, like which came first, like the idea of putting this awesome, you know, marina that's covered in sand and or the kind of poignant moral choices that came there. Like how do those interplay?
I think the set pieces came kind of first, even though they got, you know, they developed, obviously, with the story. And the story wasn't there in the beginning. The story developed very, very long and took we had a lot of iteration on the story because we felt that for a game like Spec Ops, where basically the narrative is the most important thing almost, right? We cannot fail on it. And one of the things we realized is that iterating on story is super hard to do because, you know, if you have gameplay, if you don't touch the game for a week, you come back, you take the controller, you get an idea if it's good or not, if it sucks or not. The story, once you know it, it's very hard to judge. You need someone from the outside to judge it and to see if it works in creating the emotions you're aiming for. So this is really tough to do, especially since this is something you cannot do with a gray box level, right?
Right.
if you want to get a focus tester in and you want to see how's the emotional impact of the scene, does it work, then you basically need to have final assets. You need to have final animations. You need to have final voices. You need to have an implementation which is basically close to the ship game because you can't have him distracted from anything, from any bugs or any small glitches, which would take away from the emotional experience. So that got a lot of this got iterated very late. But I think I now missed your point.
No. I think you found something better. Did you pay the focus testers extra for putting them through the emotional experience?
No, not really. No.
Yeah.
No, it's actually, but yeah, that was a tough thing to do. The set pieces, I mean, a lot of that, work came on early on, but then got iterated along the story. There were just set pieces that changed over time in tone and in meaning. So so we had to also rework, the whole set piece basically.
Understood.
Now you mentioned the emotional response. You know, the game is extremely convincing in its portrayal of the PTSD. Kind of, what was your process for researching the military mindset and PTSD and that sort of thing?
Well, we had a military advisor who actually used to work for special forces for quite a while. He's now a privateer, and he's a good friend of Corey's, and he came over to us. He did also some of the mocaps, and he basically told us stories. He told us lots of stories firsthand. That was pretty cool. That was super awesome. We could ask him everything. Of course, the team did a lot of research by, the usual stuff, right? We read books. We read all kinds of war stories and reports from soldiers coming back from the Middle East. We watched all kinds of movies and shows taking place in that area, but not just in that area, also Second World War stuff, and basically to kind of catch the theme and the emotions of war and of people in these kind of extreme situations where they need to make decisions under pressure and decisions which might not, you know, there's no good or bad. You just have to make a decision. You can't really tell what the outcome is going to be. And you need to later on live with that decision. So we try to catch that feeling. but we also try to intentionally stay away from real events, right? Okay. So we didn't take a report from a soldier and said like, okay, that's a cool set piece. We built that in the game. We didn't want to do that because we felt like that's kind of wrong, right? It's still a video game. Yeah. It's still, you know, it's just not right. But we try to get the essence and the core of this feeling more than the actual situation. I mean, if you look at the moral choices, they are all very in your face, right? And if you look at them properly, they're all very gamey. It's rather unlikely that you're gonna run into something like that in a war zone. But what they do to the player, hopefully, and it seems like for many players it worked, is that they set you under similar pressure and where you just have no fucking clue what to do now and how to act, but you need to, and you're also, you don't like either decision you have to make. You have to make one, and that's an emotion we wanted to get in. That's what we did.
Yeah.
So now, now that the game's been out for a bit, you know, what kind of response have you gotten from people? Have there been any that have been particularly memorable?
Oh yeah. We get every day lots of emails. Many positive ones. Also, people who didn't like the game. Some people were actually stopped playing it at one point because they said, "Like, yeah, I know what you guys tried to do here, but you know what? I don't like it, or I can't stand it." Also, we got one response where they basically said, "I kind of appreciate what you guys are doing, but I just can't stand it. I don't want to play it on. I don't want to be that person." And one of the most moving ones was actually. A guy who wrote us and told us that his dad was in Afghanistan for a while, and that he and his dad was always very critical towards war games, and so like they're bullshit and they're all propaganda and they tell lies and they actually lure young people into the duty and into the war. And that son showed his father Spec Ops, and that his in particular some of the decision scenes, and that his father said that this is the first game he saw which got the feeling right. That he was really moved and like almost got into tears because of the memories. And that was really read something like that is really that's really movable, and you think like, oh wow, cool. I never thought we could reach that that point, that level of you know, emotion and trigger that in players or even just people who watch it. So yeah, very happy with the response to the game.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Kind of switching gears here a little bit. One of the more memorable aspects of the presentation is the kind of the choice of music and then the role that Radio Man plays. It kind of evokes the Vietnam War, or at least like what you see, you know, from, you know, again, Apocalypse Now, like, what's his name? The photojournalist character.
Yes.
Did you have kind of any role in picking those tracks and kind of putting them to the appropriate part there? You know, especially like Nowhere to Run or Hush by Deep Purple.
Yeah, I mean, there was kind of a team collaboration. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of back and forth. I can tell you that actually picking music for a game, especially if you take known tracks and to a game like this, is a very emotional topic. And there's a lot of heat and discussion involved. We iterated. We had a wish list very early on of what we wanted where. We couldn't get everything. Some things changed actually to the better. That was nice to see. I can't really tell who in the end picked which track to where. But yeah, it was a long process, and we had it very early on. We had already music in the game because it was so important for us to transport the tone and the feeling of the game.
Yeah.
So.
Were the Vietnam parallels intentional?
Yes.
Cool.
Yes, sure. I mean, we can't deny our influences of Apocalypse Now and that whole like lost war kind of theme, right? Sure. They're basically the three guys are there and they're fighting a lost war from the beginning. There's no point. Best thing they should have done was basically return and go home right away.
I tried the second time I played the game. You don't let us do that, though.
You can't go backwards.
Don't be longer.
It's all those vertical drops.
Yeah.
You talked about so many of the parts of this game being kind of collaborations or kind of teams working on them. I'm curious if there are any parts of the game that you feel are very personal for you. Are there any levels or parts of the game that you feel like really have your fingerprints on them?
It's really tough because just especially then as a lead at one point, you're so involved in everything. And at the same time, you're not really doing the work. It's the team doing the work. And so that's really hard. But I always felt attached to the whole game. I can not so much emotional, but one of the things I'm responsible for, that I have, and I guess many of our players gonna hate me for that, is I'm responsible for the knife guy. He was my idea. He was my design. I prototyped him for a long time. I had a hard time getting him in the game because people didn't you know there was he was prototyped rather late when they were already I had no budget for him, basically, and I was prototyping the animation myself and everything. And I really wanted to have him in because I thought it's like a nice change in combat to get you out of cover at one point. So that was really so I had fun doing him. I know that many people hate him. I saw YouTube videos where like rage quits about that. So but yeah.
No, I remember I think the Aquatic Center in particular has like a couple of them that come at you, and they definitely shake things up.
I always tried to go mano a mano with them.
Yeah. Oh, we're gonna do this hand to hand, huh? So you know, it kind of in keeping with this theme of parts of the game that you liked. You know, every game has content, you know, levels or gameplay mechanics or story beats that just don't make it into the final product for one reason or another. Was there anything like that in Spec Ops? Big pieces that we never got to see?
Oh yeah, there was quite a lot. There was quite a lot. There's like there's one level I'm in particular missing. If you guys played through the mall, that's the section where the squad gets separated of you and you see them on the other side, like the doll's house section, we call them internally. Right. Okay. You know, you're on one side, they're on the other side, and eventually you meet again in the very end. And then afterwards, you are on the rooftops on a high skyscraper. And there's like a super short cutscene where basically, hey, we need to, that's when you get to the Radio Man. And there's a super short cutscene where they're like, hey, where's the Radio Man? Radio Man is up there. We need to walk up that giant dune. So we obviously had a level, which was the giant dune with the bird skyscraper, where you were fighting up your way all the time. And it was pretty nice level, but we couldn't finish it in time. There was no way. We had to focus on other stuff.
Yeah, that's very interesting thematically because you spend so much of your game going down.
Yes.
The Radio Man level is really the only place I can think of that you go up other than the elevator at the end.
Yes, indeed. Indeed. And that's kind of a symptom coming from that. We even had in the early game, we even had the ability to climb. So a little bit, Uncharted-like. Where you could actually climb on certain spots, or you actually could climb at every obstacle in a certain height. But that was something which was cut rather early in the game because we just said that's not us. We're not that kind of game. The player needs to focus on different stuff. So we streamlined it, as you say, right? Mm-hmm. And said like, okay, let's focus on the squad. That was something. The whole game originally was way more tactical. It was, you had more controls over the squad. You could give them more squad controls. I don't think that it was a bad thing that we took that out, because it just distracted so much from the story as well. You know, we had so many bits where we basically wanted to get the player and the squad interacting with each other, also in a narrative way. So in the beginning, when you could basically send the squad freely around, also the levels were bigger. And we always ran into the problem with, like, okay, what if the player sent the squad over there and they're not here when this... That actually happened all the time. So, we looked for a solution to have them around the player and still have them be an important and a useful tool, right? Sure. So stuff like this. And probably one of the biggest changes... I'm very, very, very happy that we took that out. But for a while, you know that, of course, you're aware of the phosphorus scene, right?
Mm-hmm. Right, yes, yes.
So at one point in early development, the squad had, we had more squad controls, as I said, more squad commands. The squad had a mortar with them. They were carrying a mortar, and you could actually mortar them to build up that mortar and fire with it. You had like normal ammo, and eventually at that point you would get the phosphorus one.
Oh,
use it freely.
No one would have used it, not a single person.
We figured that.
Cool.
It's just it didn't fit, right?
Yeah,
it didn't.
Yeah.
It's cool. It's a cool thing to try out in design. You want to see, like, of course, you want to have as many interactions as possible with the squad. So you try stuff out. We have that in, but yeah, didn't fit the tone of the game. It didn't fit what we wanted to achieve.
Yeah. I hope that no one would have used it. That actually kind of leads me to my next question, if you don't mind.
Sure.
The fact that, you know, so much of this game kind of feels like not just a commentary on modern shooters, the games, but on modern shooter players, the people playing the games, and this cavalier or not caring attitude that they have. Was it hard to walk that line of kind of you're catering to an audience that at the same time you're kind of calling them out?
Yeah, it was. I think it was pretty tough. I mean, it was the person having the toughest time, the hardest time, was basically was our writer, or our two writers, Walt Williams and Richard Percy, because there was, as you can imagine, you have a very enthusiastic team who actually likes shooters, right? That's why we do shooters. we're not hating shooters, and there was a lot of conflict and many people in between during the development sometimes said, like, what are we doing here? That's there's no point. This is all depressive. This is turning people off. Why are we doing that? That's the fool. I mean, in the end, everybody saw that we did something outstanding and something so unique and unusual that it was really worth it. But there were definitely doubts, and the writers had a hard time convincing the team that this is the right thing to do and that we should proceed with it. Me personally, I liked that path. I really liked it. I thought, like, hey, I really thought, like, this is a once in a lifetime opportunity to doing something like that with a big budget and actually going full blown in and starting out as a normal shooter, and then down that path, luring people down there and confront them with their own kind of Heart of Darkness while playing a shooter, which is, again, it was a great opportunity to do, and it was just fantastic.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Very cool.
So thinking about the experience of playing through this game, when we were talking about it last night, it kind of reminded me of the movie Funny Games by Michael Haneke.
Yeah.
And how with that movie, if you watch it to the end, then you have failed as an audience member, because you're not supposed to want to watch it. Is it similar with the game? If you beat this game, did you actually lose?
I don't know. I don't know if you can say that. I mean, what we hope to achieve is that people, played through the game and actually and still felt attached to it and had to think about what the game told them, but also what they did during the game. I don't want to, and we never had the intention to blame shooter players, right? We all play shooters. We love shooters. I don't think anyone playing a shooter is a bad person. But we do something in those games which is kind of questionable, right? So running through an area and killing hundreds of people is kind of questionable.
No, it's okay to say that's bad, yeah.
to do. And we felt like not many games ask the player the question or make him think a little bit beyond that point and thought like, hey, what did I just did there? And yes, those are all polygons and they're not real and it was just fiction. But even in my brain, what did I just do? And why did I enjoy it? And again, I'm still playing shooters and I'm still enjoying them. But I think it doesn't hurt to reflect what we do also with our medium at this point. Mm-hmm. I think we're a grown up medium now, or I hope we are, at least we're getting there. So every medium did that. If you look at the Western movies, the Italo-Westerns from the late 60s, early 70s, they started doing that. They still followed the Western genre, Wild West movies, that is, sorry. But they started to question that. They showed the characters who used to be heroes in Wild West movies from the 50s in a broken way. And they asked the question, okay, there's this guy who is a hero or supposed to be a hero, kills so many people. What does it do to that person? What happens to him? Is he really a hero? Or is he a maniac? Is he a weird, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're kind of running up on time here, but do you have any kind of final remarks that you would like to leave us with?
No, not really. I enjoyed talking to you guys. It was fun. I'm happy you liked Spec Ops, and I hope you're going to look forward to the next Jaeger game.
Most certainly.
Definitely. Oh yeah, absolutely. We definitely are. And if I might be so presumptuous, I'm glad you had a good time. We had a great time. Maybe once you're actually allowed to say anything about that game or once that game has come out and we've played it, we'd love to have you back on the show and kind of do a follow-up to this because it's been a great time.
Sure. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Okay, awesome. Guys.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you so much. We really enjoyed the game. We really enjoyed talking with you.
Thank you.
So yeah, thanks again to Jörg Friedrich for joining us for that. It was incredibly kind of him to make the time and get on here and share those details about this awesome game with us. We hope that you enjoyed listening to that as much as we enjoyed kind of performing the interview. So yeah, it was fantastic. I think everybody would agree. So
one thing, Cole.
Go ahead.
And I hate to just as a point of order, I'm going to go ahead and excuse myself. I thought this podcast was about Spec Ops Airborne Soldier from 1999. And then all those shoot mechanics. So I'll see you guys later.
Okay. it's not about being a shoot man. It's about being a sad man.
Spec Ops: Deadly Territory.
Spec Ops: the Adventures of Sad Man in Sandville.
Yeah.
So, yeah,
this is why you do not do marketing.
Billy and the Clonosaurus. Dennis, why don't you usher in our own personal discussion of Spec Ops by kind of describing a little bit about the plot high points so we can so everybody can be refreshed as we talk about the more esoteric points here.
Yeah, and I'm going to blow through the game. This is a 30,000 foot view of it. And if you're listening, you already have played the game. You know all the spoilers, so it's not important for us to get super focused on plot. Yeah, if you're still figuring that out, you might want to get some things checked.
It's your fault.
Yeah,
but you're still a good person.
Well, I wouldn't say that. I mean, we don't know some of these people listening. So
how many Americans have you killed today?
Oh, my God. I'm just going to go cry in a corner now. That's going to be the rest of the podcast. No, but on the level, we're not about gaming news, though we talk about that. We're not about reviews or any of that stuff. We just really like to share the experiences we have playing games, and Spec Ops was more packed with those experiences than most games, So I'm going to go real quick through the plot, and then we're just going to get into our reactions and thoughts on those experiences. So plot overview. You are Martin Walker, sent with your team to see if there are any survivors of the 33rd's failed evacuation attempt from the horrible sandstorms ravaging Dubai. Your arrival seems to set off chaos between the refugees and the 33rd, and you decide to find John Conrad, an old friend and the leader of the original evacuation, to make sense of what's happening. Your attempts to defend yourself and rescue anyone who might know what's going on only lead to more death and destruction, as it becomes clear that the 33rd has gone rogue and the CIA is leading the refugees against them to cover everything up. After committing unspeakable acts, you make contact with Conrad, only to find out that he has been leading the 33rd and causing these horrible events. You decide to side with the CIA and steal the 33rd's water supply, only to have the CIA destroy it in hopes of wiping out all survivors, both 33rd and refugees. You make one last ditch effort to organize an evacuation, but your helicopter is shot down in the resulting battle with the 33rd, and one of your teammates is injured and separated from you. He tries to hide in a refugee camp, but you reach him only in time to see him hung by the refugees you were trying to save. In your ensuing rage, you make an all-out assault on Conrad's base, and your remaining teammate is killed in the process. Alone and broken, you finally reach Conrad, or rather Conrad's body. He's been dead the whole time, and you've been imagining him to cope with and externalize the atrocities that you've caused. That's Spec Ops in about 30 seconds.
And it ends in a musical number.
Oh, my God. I must have missed that one.
Gotcha. Special operations, kid, yeah. Special operations. Crossing the line. The chorus line.
So I feel like we can kind of start then in on kind of some general things about the story themes that we saw, and kind of this is where we'll get more loosey-goosey, open it up to conversation. I guess starting this game is obviously very heavily talks about PTSD, right, guys?
Yeah.
I think that'd be fair to say.
Directly at one point, I know that and we'll talk about these in general in a bit, but the loading screens, not everyone gets every loading screen, but one of them actually suggests something. We talked about Lugo dying. One of the loading screens alludes to him being luckier being dead because he would go back to the United States with tons of PTSD and emotional damage.
If he would have survived.
Yeah.
And when I saw that loading screen the first time, I totally disagreed with it. And then by the end of the game, I was like, they might have had a point.
That's definitely something. Like, you know, nobody comes out of this good. Like, even if Walker does survive at the end of the game, you know, well, I guess survivor's guilt would be the least of his worries.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I don't know. But definitely the big thing about this game is watching how all of these atrocities that you commit, like, just completely degrade this dude who starts out entirely likable at the start.
I think you heard Jorg say that he starts out very Nathan Drake-ish.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Given that he's voiced by Nolan North.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, is that the same guy?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay. That now makes more sense.
And credit to him. I actually didn't put that together until most of the way through the game. So,
see, I knew it going in ahead of time, which, I feel guilty about this now. That may have been one of the contributing factors in me, like, not paying too much attention to this when it first came out. Because, like, when this was first announced, they were saying, this is a different kind of shooter. And I was like, nah. And it's kind of like, oh, like Nolan North voicing the main character? Nah, he's the default main character in every video game. And I couldn't have been more wrong, because it's a horror game, guys.
Yeah, pretty much.
I felt like the voice acting was actually one of the more effective ways of communicating that, where particularly the call-outs during combat, how those shifted.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And get more ragged as the game goes on.
When was the first time that you guys noticed that that the voice acting and the banter, if you will, was changing?
The first time I heard Walker say "kill fucking confirmed."
Yeah.
Oh, see, I actually didn't notice. I didn't notice that just because that still struck me as a little whatever. I don't know. I didn't notice it till much later on. Once the team was starting to break apart, and then it becomes real obvious after Hugo dies. Oh, God, Lugo.
Lugo. I think Hugo's a car.
Along the same lines, noticing how the animation shifted too when you execute somebody, where at the beginning you kind of punch them in the face a little bit, and at the end you're putting your gun like really close to their face and then blowing them away.
Yeah, it goes from a coup de grace to like just a straight up, you know, primal execution.
Yeah. I think the way that we can all have different interpretations on when we notice that really credits how subtle it is. So like it's a real gradual slide into monsterism.
Yeah,
you know, for the people who are touched by this. Cole, when you talk about the way that it was marketed and getting the Nathan Drake guy and everything, one of my favorite things about this game and one of the things that I think is most noteworthy is the way that, you know, the reaction you had, like, I don't want to play a shooter with Nathan Drake as the voice. You know, this is I don't believe it. Like, that's really kind of intentional and important to the game that it comes off as, you know, at least in my interpretation of it, that it comes off as something a lot less special than it is. You know, if it started out throwing all these references, it started out, you know, quite as nuanced as it becomes, you know, it'd be way too hard of a pill to swallow, and it wouldn't really contact, you know, a lot of, you know, the audience for it, you know, for these kind of games.
It's interesting, though. I agree with you. There's definitely a progression. However, I think they do things to let you know this is not going to be your typical shooter from the very beginning. Did anyone notice that their name was worked into the opening credits?
Yes, I did notice that.
Yeah, guest starring you.
Yeah.
Even the title screen, right? So, like, the title screen, it's an upside-down American flag with Jimi Hendrix's version of the Star-Spangled Banner, you know, which are both, like, symbols of America kind of broken and upside down and skewed.
Right.
You know, so they definitely do some symbolizing of it, but the playing with the tropes of a traditional military game in the beginning of this game is really important.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like,
but I also feel like it kind of captures, at least, you know, from, you know, some of the people in college that were there on the GI Bill, you know, kind of the other side of the military experience, which is kind of the camaraderie and, you know, kind of, you know, a lot of the stories they would tell were just them dicking around doing dumb stuff. I feel like it kind of leads in with that part of the experience.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It leads in with esprit de corps and then just, you know, fades away into straight up core. And by core, I mean corpses. it would have been I would have played it and fucking loved it if it like was straight up titled, you know, Jacob's Apocalypse Ladder Now. But the surprise, you know, the surprise is definitely worth it.
Yeah. I found it very interesting, you know, even though like you said, it does play with these tropes. The first time you ever fire a gun, it's completely shrouded in uncertainty.
Yeah. Well, one of the things, and this plays into a lot of the other choices, but one of the biggest themes I took away from this game that I, you know, is definitely important in the military, and I wish it was heated more often, but is something that I think about in my real life, is kind of the danger of making really weighty decisions without having complete information.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the time, the kind of death and destruction that follows in your wake in this game comes from you doing things that seem right at the time. You know, this is a real good intentions kind of based, you know, game. But because you don't really know the whole picture, and because you can't know the whole picture, you are, you know, people, like the first people you run into aren't terrorists waiting to jump you. Mm-hmm. You know, like they don't know who you are. Like they have incomplete reason or incomplete information, so they're aggressive. You have incomplete information and they're aggressive to you, so you're aggressive back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the motivations are 100% muddied and mixed, and that's a real dangerous thing to do when you're carrying around a gun.
Yeah.
You know, like if you're making a decision to shoot somebody, you know, and I'm not, and that's, you know, that's something that the military does and has always had to do, and it's part of it. right? So like you can't have complete information, but it carries weight.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know?
I also thought it was extremely important that they gave you an out that was not just directly shooting at them. So I'm curious, going around, how many people waited, how many people shot the people, and how many people shot the window?
I shot the window.
I waited.
Yeah,
I waited and then shot the window.
Yeah, I suppose.
Yeah, I shot the window. Yeah.
That's what I did too.
Which, yeah, like, if you think about it, like, it's either okay, shoot somebody in the head and they die instantly, or you'll be suffocated and crushed to death.
Yeah,
like why does that seem more merciful?
But there's this layer of.
It's indirect killing.
Yes. Okay, yeah, so it's like when there's a lethal injection and they get like five people to press a button, so none of them feels guilty. No individual grain of sand out of those millions there needs to feel guilty about that. Nor does the bullet.
I don't know. I guess I never thought about it as being more or less merciful. It just, not to sound like an awful person, but it just struck me as more efficient.
Oh, one bullet to kill six people as opposed to six bullets to kill six people.
Right, and gives them less time to shoot at me.
I mean, at this point in the game, you don't really have the vision of what the game is going to become. So, I mean, for me when I did this, it was just like, oh, this is a shooter. Oh, that's like the special thing I can shoot to kill them in a different way. It's kind of like a flammable barrel, but it's sand.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
Which, what did you guys think of the sand and the sandstorms throughout the game? Did you like the way it was used?
I loved it. I mean, you know, the every environment of the game is, you know, almost overtly meant to kind of like mimic or, you know, indicate Walker's emotional state, and just kind of this contrast of like, you know, destroyed beauty and other video game cliches. God help me. The way that it came in and made each stage dynamic. There's a scene that follows up pretty close after this where just like the ground straight up falls out underneath you. And like that put me on edge for, if not the entire game after that, at the very least, like the majority of the time that I didn't have my feet on terra firma.
And they do it to you once again right after you've forgotten about the first time.
Yeah, yeah.
See, I really liked the sand. One of my childhood memories, I don't know why, is going on vacation to these like sand dunes and finding like a castle in the middle of the sand dunes. And find out that basically someone had thought it was a good idea to build a putt-putt course in the middle of the sand dunes, and all that was left was one of the castles sticking up above it. So it really, I don't know, for me, it really reminded me of that.
It's nature reclaiming, right? And then that is an incredibly powerful, you know, visual and thematic thing.
I think also we talk about the intersection of gameplay and kind of the theme or the narrative on the level a lot of times. And one of the things that the sandstorm freed me to do was to go into like a real aggressive Rambo-y, you know, run around with a shotgun hip firing kind of mode, because there's so much chaos, because you can't give squad commands anymore. You know, you're allowed to be much more aggressive and just abandon all caution to take it. In my mind, it was a situation to take advantage of. And I hadn't thought about it reflecting Walker's emotional state before you said that. And that fits really well. Like the game got me to act the way Walker was feeling without directly telling me it was my objective to act that way.
See, it's funny because I always used it as cover, like a way to get from point A to point B without, you know, like just with limited visibility on the enemy's part.
Huh.
So yeah, it was just kind of like, how do I get there quicker? Oh, here's this thing. I'm going to make a beeline for what seems like the most apparent path.
Yeah, I use it as an excuse to get melee attacks because I like melee attacks, but...
I like how this is showing everybody's true colors.
Well, just like the Walking Dead episode. Holy shit.
Yeah, maybe you're just making up ground for that.
What difficulty did you guys play it on, if I could ask? Because, I mean, talking about the difficulty of this game seems to miss the point a lot, but I think that there's an interesting way that the kind of just, you know, shoot, cover, shoot, cover, shoot, cover thing kind of changes meaning partway through the game, or at least it did for me. And my first playthrough was hard, and that kind of played into it.
I played on normal.
I played on normal too.
Yeah, same here.
I played it on easy just because I got it like 2 days before the interview and needed to get through it.
Which it's interesting. We mentioned the loading screens at the top of the episode, and that you know, if you play through on easy, if you do too well, you almost miss a very powerful part of the game.
Oh yeah, I did not get any of the weird loading screens, not a single one.
Yeah,
yeah, that's a shame. Like, I mean, not that, you know, you had any control over it, but that was one of my favorite parts.
Yeah.
One story thing with the sand though. They keep talking about the storm wall. Is it your guys' interpretation that the sandstorm is still kind of swirling around Dubai, or what exactly this storm wall is that's keeping him from getting to the outside world?
Yeah.
It's just the wind.
Like a storm front? You know, like the same way you'd have like a kind of like a weather system that is ripe for sandstorms.
That was
supposed to be like 3 months later, right?
Three months after the first storm is what they say. The first storm was what prompted the evacuation attempt, and the sandstorms have been ongoing ever since.
This was very, very interesting to me, because think about the opening of the game, and I think we can talk a bit about unreality in the game here, because at the start of the game, you walk through that storm with no seeming additional protection. You don't even have like a Humvee or anything like that. You just kind of walk through it, which I imagine would be like walking through a hurricane or something like that to get to the beginning. And, you know, I don't think the first time I played it, I noticed anything, because I'm like, oh, sandstorm. And then throughout the game, I realized how serious these things were. You can't even get a signal through. So it just struck me as really interesting that it's starts off with this note of things might not be as they seem. I almost read it a little bit as like, you know, it's all in your mind, or you just, there's a big undercurrent of unreality and hallucination to the game.
I mean, they could have gotten in on a lull.
Yeah.
You know,
see, it kind of strikes me as almost like a House of Leaves type thing, where it's, you know, you start out relatively innocent, so the sandstorm doesn't screw with you. Whereas once you get in and, you know, you're no longer pure or whatever, then you're part of the system and you can't get out.
Makes sense.
Do you think they intended for that, though? Because in the interview, he just said that it was a means to make a power vacuum so that somebody like Conrad could exist.
Yeah. No, that is fair.
I think it likely was just kind of,
If you think about it in terms of like literary theory, you know, I have a hard time with this too. But you're not supposed to care if the author intended it. You're supposed to just, you know, the fun is, or not the fun, but the value is interpreting it yourself. So even if the author didn't intend it, you know, it still has value.
Right.
I have a hard time with that too. But that's the party line. Let's cross it.
The party line.
That's when you get in a line and have a party, right?
I was thinking it's going to be the sequel, Spec Ops: The Party Line.
I'm so glad during that interview he doesn't talk about a sequel, that they moved on to another project.
Oh yeah,
not that they could, but I was just like, oh man, like this was a big success. I really hope that they don't.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sequels.
Opening. Interior. Mental asylum. You see a shadow cast along the floor. You hear a door opening up. Walker looks up. He's like huddled over a bowl of gruel. And then a commander is dressed with lots of metal. Yeah. Says, "Walker, Dubai needs you." Spec Ops 2, the party line.
Yeah,
you're invited for a party.
Lugo narrative dissonance.
Yeah, I was thinking when they were talking about 2K, yo, bringing them in to relaunch this Spec Ops, you know, series or whatever, they kind of ran that into the ground a little bit.
This is true.
Yeah. Like, Grant, you know, that's kind of the way it's supposed to be, is you make a good story and it's good enough that you don't need a sequel. But if they really wanted to make it a series, this, I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. What did they gain from making this a Spec Ops game? Like, as opposed to making it a new property? Because any fans of the old series are not going to, they're not the target audience for this game. And the name recognition it has, like, I mean, if you're not trying to, I mean, for lack of a gentler word, trick people into playing the game, like, what, I wonder what the advantage was for them to make this actually a Spec Ops game instead of making it, you know, I don't know,
just the
calling
line.
It Walker Quest or something like that, the Windwalker.
Maybe it was cheaper. They didn't have to pay for new IP or like copyright anything.
Or maybe they wanted to keep the IP alive. Like maybe there was you know, they run up on some kind of weird deadline.
It could have been Walker Dubai Ranger.
Kind of, yeah.
Oh, no. How cool would it be, though, if Spec Ops became a franchise not of linearly connected games, but just these are the shooters that will make you think. Like, these are the Citizen Kane to Modern Warfare's Dumb and Dumber.
Kind of like American Horror Story, but in video game form?
It feels like such a singular work, though. Like, if something else tried these same tricks... or something like, you know, thematically linked. Again, I'm a person who is a sucker for, you know, horror series, right? Like, you're not seeing an awful lot of new stuff beyond, like, Silent Hill 2. Like, it's all the same kind of thing. Like, I don't know how effective it would be if they, like, tried to serialize this.
You'd have to go at it from another angle. Like, the next game would have to be about, like, a wife that was left at home during war or something like that. Like, I'm not kidding, man. Like, it would have to be, what other ways does war, you know, affect people? And you could not tread the same ground.
Right.
You know, like it would have to be 100% different, approach it from a totally different angle, you know, because they can't do this again.
You know? I almost just feel the like mark of like working. Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say that's one of the marks of like really, you know, great art, right? Like you can't just like do this trick again.
Right.
You know,
Fast and Furious 6. Hello.
Final Fantasy 7.
Counterpoint taken. Yeah.
Do you guys want to talk at all about the intersection of some of the game mechanics into your experience?
Can you clarify that for me?
Just kind of interesting things that the game does mechanically. So we already kind of talked about the sandstorms that change the way you play. The execute was a really interesting piece that you know, changed across the game. Anything like that? So your squad commands, the shooting cover or mechanics.
Oh, here's something. I'm sorry to interrupt you, Gary, but this I just want to get this out because it feels kind of minor. I don't know if it will get a chance again. Like, have you guys did you guys ever like, you know, command your squad to attack like people?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's civilians. Mm-hmm.
No. Okay, I'll mark you down for yes on civilian slaughter.
I guess actually probably the worst part of that is not so much that the idea of civilians, that apparently I generalize the characters in the game to civilians and non-people. Yeah. Think about that for a second.
A little bit. Well, that's an uncomfortable thing we'll get to when we talk about American soldiers.
When we do the podcast on David Moneysmith, we'll talk about that.
Yeah. That's the end game for this, right? Where we just like dive into each other's ideas. Yeah.
I'm just kidding.
But if you like, you know, if you highlight somebody and say like, hey, attack that dude, the amount of contextual dialogue that they recorded for person next to the boat or like next to the T-Rex or whatever, like the specific callouts that happen, just kind of like, it's not something I did very often. It was more something I did just to see if they would like have dialogue to account for that thing.
And someone did you try it at all after Lugo died?
No.
It really, really changes.
Huh.
Like Adam's responses, I this isn't word for word, but come along, it become things like, oh, so you think someone else needs to die?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, or, you know, stuff like that. I mean, that's actually where I really noticed that the, going back to the previous point, that the dialogue was changing was that point.
Yeah, or do you, just his responses are for things like just his tone being like, yeah, whatever you say. Mm-hmm. Like it's very clear he's given up in his mind.
Yeah.
But as someone who relied on squad commands very heavily throughout, the dialogue holds up. Like you know, in the times you used it and he was very specific, they are that specific throughout the entire game.
Right.
Yeah. Well, and they have to create that, right? So like part of that, you know, and that can kind of fall under the greater umbrella of squad interactions, is to make you feel attached to these people so they can break that part of you. You know, like we need to make, and they succeeded for me, right? Yeah. Like, so yeah. I partly through those mechanical interactions and partly just through the really excellent, you know, dialogue, like these characters felt like they knew each other. They felt like they had a, you know, a good rapport, you know, respect and everything. And then to totally destroy them as a unit, you know, they had to build that up to deconstruct it. Mm-hmm. And I think of those as part of that. When you talk about the intersection of the mechanics and how that affect the narrative, one thing that came to me, and this was specifically playing it on hard, where I died frequently, to the close combat guys, which
thanks, Jorg.
Yeah. and then the heavies as well, the armored guys, oftentimes killed me. So I was dying a lot. I was seeing the messages, but I was also getting bored shooting regular soldiers in a way that I thought, if this was more mechanically interesting and more tactically, kind of, and I love this game to death, but to call it a better game, the play was a little bit better, it would lose something, because by the time I was sick of just clicking on things to make them die, like I felt mirrored by the character a little bit,
right?
Or that might have been the way it was kind of rote and mechanical for me would be the same way it would be after killing, untold number of people, for the main character, for Walker.
Like that, so I got the sense that Walker was just rock hard as he was doing all this stuff. It was more Adams and Lugo who were just completely over, how many people they were killing at this point.
Yeah. I didn't get rock hard. I just kind of got, I understand that there's a hatred and a misplaced anger, for these, some of it's misplaced, some of it's well-placed anger for these people. But at the same time, this kind of desensitive, maybe the way that I was desensitized to the act of, playing the game, he was desensitized. That's a better way to put what I meant.
Yeah.
He was desensitized to, murdering people who presumably have wives and families.
Yeah, just to where it becomes not presumably, they talk about it.
Yeah, exactly. People want to borrow gum from each other.
Yeah, it becomes entirely mechanical for you, just like it does for him, like your drive to work, right?
Two thoughts on that. Probably the most emotionally hard part of the game for me. Obviously after the White Phosphorus scene, you find the civilians, and that's incredibly hard. But as you're taking that in yourself, you hear Adams and Lugo arguing in the background. And Adams says, he turned us into fucking killers.
Yeah.
And I felt that weight of responsibility. This isn't just me doing horrible things. I brought my friends into this with me.
Yeah.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. The other piece, oh shoot, man, I lost, I had two thoughts on there, but forget it.
Okay.
What was the? Oh, I'll come back to it, I'm sure.
Okay.
One of the areas where gameplay really, for me, I felt was a good intersection. There's a number of things in the game that are really less than realistic. Particularly in the second half, it kind of switches over to a bit more. You're surviving airplane crashes and, just wiping out entire armies. And I felt like it kind of did a good job of, once you switch over to revenge mode, you almost become kind of a force of nature type thing. Where you're just wiping these people out.
What God of War should have been.
Yeah.
How they show you that there's a finite supply of military people at the end of the game, and you just see all that's left of the army.
Yeah.
Eight people.
So think about this, the force of nature kind of thing. The game pulls, giving you a taste of power at the beginning and then taking it away and then giving it back to you later. But the context for that is entirely different. When you open up and you're manning the Gatling gun at the side of that helicopter, it was like, fucking ooh-rah, man. We're going to be taking out some what I presume to be Arabs. But not really. Like when you get back to it, you feel entirely different about it than you did at the beginning.
Oh, and by the way, in that opening scene, the very first helicopter that you shoot down, you don't notice it when you play the game for the first time. The very first helicopter you shoot at has an American flag draped on it.
Oh, really?
If you're paying attention, you could realize from the beginning that something is horribly wrong.
Oh, nice.
Am I the only one that was careful not to shoot through windows or to purposely do it above human height?
How considerate of you.
No, probably. I'm a horrible person.
Yeah, probably, because at that point, and we'll talk about it when we get to the next, or one of the bigger choices that come a little bit later, the game kind of did a number on me to where I was identifying with the character enough to where I was doing pretty terrible things. For reasons I didn't totally understand.
Yeah.
And I didn't give a shit at that point. It was just kind of, I really, really felt along with in a way that I haven't since The Walking Dead, felt along with the character. When you talk about that force of nature bit though, that makes me think one of the things is the second half of the game, it becomes this unrealistic, shoot fest, similar to like a lot of other games. And one of the things I love about it is it's taking, you know, kind of a standard one man against the world video game trope and showing you how that could feel, you know, right. in a way mm-hmm. other than empowerment. Like you right. are really empowered, but the game isn't doing its job unless you feel like absolute shit at that point. Like you yeah. are a god, but you are a terrible god. You know, you are an awful force of nature.
Well, and they, you know, after that point, the more choices drop out a lot. It's almost, you know, you're no longer completely in control.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, and that brings me back to the point I couldn't think of earlier, which was that, you know, in order for the character to be able to continue, he has to be the one who's most aggressive about, you know, going after these people, because he has to externalize what's happening to be someone else's fault. And for him to truly believe that and to be able to cope with it, he has to believe that all these people deserve to be killed and gone after the way that he's going after them.
And he has to believe that, like, at the end of this, he's going to kill the thing that will make it all better.
Yes.
As a side note, are we going to circle around and talk about some of our
let's hit that and then kind of like go back through and then just I don't know. Let's play it like freeform jazz.
Well, what were you thinking of specifically, David?
Oh, I was just going to say my take on it. I truly do think the soldiers deserve to die, and that it wasn't Walker's fault.
The situation in its entirety, or which specific parts?
I would say in terms of the moral choices, I think all the moral choices I made, you know, with the information I had at the time, I would stand by. I mean, some of them had consequences I didn't like, but I don't think any of them were the wrong choice. Without having 20/20 hindsight.
So Dennis, perhaps you could fill us in since you played it twice. But like, it does seem like they kind of pulled a bait and switch as far as like making the American soldiers look like the monsters in the beginning, and then, you know, switching it midway through. Because like the first couple times you see them, you know, they're either shooting at you, or after the ambush scene, you think that they're shooting civilians. And, like, mm-hmm. that's the first time you actually go after them and shoot them.
Yeah. And they are shooting civilians, at least according to the radio man. He gives the whole, you know, I'm sure you're asking why right now. You brought this on yourself, which is something that's repeated throughout the game. Yeah. But then he says, you know, the only thing I can give you is the perfect tune to play out on. So I think, yeah, the soldiers are, as a whole, committing horrible atrocities. I think that there are several points within the game where they show you that, you know, it's chaos there, and I don't think it's as unified a faction of evil as you would right. think. So, for example, the people who were, I mean, I don't know if they were rescuing the civilians or transporting them or what, but in the White Phosphorus, they were, you know, at least not actively hurting the civilians. There is the soldier that surrenders after you do the big turret fight. And I'm sure some other examples that I'm not thinking of immediately, but you know, at the end of the day, they're doing unspeakable things, but they're still humans too. You know, they're not universally bad, which is, I mean, that's what's happening to you, right?
But what I'm saying, go ahead.
I'm not necessarily saying that. For example, specifically the White Phosphorus. You know, kind of my take on that was I wouldn't have chosen to do that, but my kind of feeling was, you know, at that point they backed me into a wall, and you know,
but they kind of didn't. The game backed you into a wall to do that.
Yes. Well, this would probably be my one complaint with the game is the fact that you truly don't have any choice in those scenarios.
I would argue that your choice could be to stop playing.
Yeah.
When they have an infinite number of snipers who keep replenishing after you shoot them, that I thought that was frustrating. Giving the illusion that you could fight this battle when you can't.
We all tried, right? Like, we all tried to go down the ladder, right?
Yeah. At
that point, refresh my memory, somebody who is I played it pretty recently, but I just want to check my memory versus everyone else's. The point at which you get to the white phosphorus, the reason why you're pushing on at that point, like you're not leaving. And multiple times before this, you say, like, we're just in and out. We're just going to find out what's happening. And at that point, I kind of read it as, you know, your character is going to get to the bottom of this, right? Like, it was like that was your motivation, which is not necessarily strong enough to kill. I mean, it's from my perspective, like, to kill that many people. You know, this wasn't where if you had known the civilians were down there or were trying to protect them, that could be one thing. But you, like, it kind of plays into what I was saying earlier, where you're confused and you have huge gaps in what you know about this situation. Right. And that remains true the entire time, but you act regardless. And I mean, I guess it's a matter of perspective whether, you know, the choice to act is the right one. And it's a matter of the fact that it's a video game that's the only choice if you're continuing to play.
Right.
But, you know, I don't think that, like, if you there was a button that was like radio for reinforcements, or a button that was, you know, desert, or there was a button that was, you know, go home or get some intel, or, you know, put this off a week while you figure out what's going on, you know, I would have pressed it.
Oh, yeah,
I think that definitely would have been the right choice. So, like, within the game, it was, you know, a fine choice. But within, like, it as a narrative, if we kind of free the constraints of the fact that it's a game, I don't think that it was a good choice at that point. I remember him being under-motivated.
I think perhaps it might have been better had they not shown you the white phosphorus before that choice scene. Just because, obviously, since we'd all seen that before, you know, a couple of scenes before, it was like, well, no, I don't want to put somebody through that. But I think it might have been more effective had you not known about what white phosphorus is, and then be more willing to just try this new weapon out and then be, you know, surprised at the horror of it, you know?
Yeah, that was one thing that I was a little disappointed. Not in the game, but they do the same thing in the exact same thing in Homefront. So I feel like it probably, you know, it was not nearly as shocking for me as it was like the first time around when I played Homefront.
I think it speaks to the how powerful that was that. You know, we're all complaining that we weren't given other options. But right. I think the real thing that I struggled with, or that I thought about after the fact, was, you know, I did this thing, even though it was in simulation, even though, you know, obviously it's through the lens of a video game and I want to experience the rest of it and blah, blah, blah. I was still willing to set this knowing full well exactly what I was doing to the people. Mm-hmm. And so the game, I think we're all really uncomfortable with the fact that the game didn't give us any refuge of, you know, oh, I didn't know what I was doing, or I didn't realize how bad it was going to be. You know, we knew exactly what we were doing to those soldiers. And I think that's something, you know, we didn't have as much choice in the game and as many options, but I don't think the ultimate goal of the game was to make it as, you know, sandboxy as possible and give you as much choice as possible. It was kind of to force you to face what you are willing to do in these simulated situations and what that might do to a person in real life.
All that I can think to say is that Walker by that point had already made up his mind to use it when he got there. Like, just kind of like, okay, that's what we're going to do. We're going to go for it. And that was the character's will superseding the player's will. Right.
Right.
Yeah. And to your point, Dennis, contrast that. So I found that scene to be kind of a direct allusion to like the infamous like Modern Warfare.
Yeah.
I've seen that Call of Duty 4 scene with the where you're using the eye in the sky to kill the troops. And I don't know, like, has everyone played that?
Which Modern Warfare is it?
Four.
Call of Duty 4, Modern Warfare 1.
The first one, the one that's decent.
Yeah.
But it's.
Yeah, because, I mean, that's a very similar scene where you have a bird's eye view of totally, you know, anonymous soldiers and are raining down death on them. And the kind of way that they handle it in that is that they have real-life audio of soldiers while you're doing it, kind of going, you know, kaboom, you got them. Like these kind of detached, this is business as usual, you know. And that, like, that seemed like a contrast to me, whereas in, you know, Call of Duty 4, like, you're supposed to feel a little weird about that. In this one, you're supposed to be like, actually, you know what? That's fucking horrible. Like, this is right. A horrible thing.
Yeah. And even if you're not in the middle of, like, you know, the crazy balloon vision that you're getting, like, it makes you climb down that ladder and see the exact consequences of what you did.
Yeah, that part was freaking creepy.
That were people are crawling around. Did you guys? I killed anyone who was crawling around.
Oh God, yeah, yeah.
I two-tapped mercy bullets them. All around.
Yeah, like, no, like just I was handing them out like fucking Pez.
Yeah. Yeah, and the entire game, anybody who was, you know, crawling around, not dead, I would shoot them in the head.
Yeah.
So. Yeah.
Nobody else did that?
I actually did not. I was trying to figure out if there was a way to help them.
Hmm.
I backed away from them because I didn't want to get caught on fire. Now I feel like a terrible person.
So, Dennis, did you mercy kill the on fire people?
After the white phosphorus scene?
Yeah, yeah.
The first time through, I didn't. The second time through, I did. And it's like the first time through, I didn't realize. It just didn't occur to me to mercy kill them. And I both times I heard the one guy begging to be killed, and I couldn't find him.
Yeah, yeah.
That's haunting. Thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was inside you all along. Sweet dreams.
Yeah, right. But the second time through, you know, the second time through, I was like, sorry, 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 sorry.
Okay, sorry, everybody line up.
Yeah.
Line up for apologies.
a hollow point, geez, what?
You're almost
not all the points. Yeah. That's a war crime. Can't be that.
Oh, jeez.
You know what an apology is, don't you?
Yeah. It's a love letter straight from my fucking heart. Yeah. You get an apology from me, you're fucked forever. Okay. I'll stop now.
Yeah, mother and daughter, eh, guys? Yikes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that marked me, I think. It's one of those moments up there with, man, I don't even know.
Strangling.
She was shielding her eyes.
Yeah.
Sorry.
That was very, very powerful.
Say what you will, like I said earlier, the fight that it caused and the discussion that it caused for my teammates was just as bad for me.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things when I saw that scene that struck me is, you know, at the final thing in that white phosphorus thing is you have to take out the Hummers that end up being right next to the huge group of civilians.
Mm-hmm.
However, I didn't do that. I dropped one on the civilians and then dropped a second one on the Hummers.
Did you know that they were civilians when you dropped it?
No, I didn't realize that. No. Okay. So, but then afterwards, it's like, no, this wasn't even like, sort of like, oh, I was, you know, they were too close. This was like, oh, these people need to die.
Oh.
Yeah.
But, I did think it was interesting. I think I mentioned this when we were discussing earlier. One of our viewers, Slate, is you know, in the military and, you know, has some training with, you know, viewing some of the screens and stuff. And he was saying he actually, as soon as he saw it, realized they were civilians.
Huh.
Wow.
That's got to be more frustrating.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
if you can tell, because then since this is one of the, you know, the times the game gives you a choice are really intentional. And this one, you know, other than just you have to play forward, is most of the other choices are played pretty straight. The other like big three moral choices that I can think of, like it actually is a choice. This is the one where it's definitely not. And if you knew the consequences ahead of time, I imagine this being really frustrating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So like this sets up kind of this weird trichotomy, a tracheotomy. No, but between, so you're dealing with a couple of different factions that you might have sympathy for. Right. So the civilians, which I think, you know, I mean, I unanimously tried to do whatever was best for them. Mm-hmm. Then there's the 33rd, who are American troops, who I don't know why, but I felt worse killing American troops than I did, you know, insurgents, quote unquote, the dehumanized other. Mm-hmm. And then there's the CIA, who you should know not to trust because they're the CIA. But, you know, they ended up being kind of like the motivating force forward for the middle third of the game, for the second act, right?
Yeah. And I would like to draw the distinction between there are civilians that are not rising up, which I think are the ones that you hit with white phosphorus, and then there are the civilians that have been mobilized by the CIA.
The insurgents, yeah.
The insurgents, yeah. At least in my mind, I drew a line between the two.
Hmm. See, for me, I really liked the Walker character because almost all of his justifications were my justifications. Kind of my view, and this is what he says, is they weren't soldiers anymore. It really didn't bother me fighting the soldiers. Those were probably the group I least identified with.
Right.
Just because, I don't know, I felt like they were the ones that most should have known better.
Hmm.
That is fair, yeah. And I think for the group that we have been built up to expect to be the heroes the most, it feels like the biggest betrayal to have them be the bad guys. And so, yeah, I mean, Cole, you said, you know, CIA is the CIA. Of course they're bad guys and something's wrong there. You know, the insurgents are that externalized other because, you know, they have different skin color and we're horrible people. But the American troops, like, we idolize them, we play as them, we are playing as them. And, you know, that's if you take it within that story context, like you said, they should know better. You expect more out of them. And within the story, the fact that they are acting as agents of evil is the biggest betrayal.
They take large steps to humanize them, though.
Yeah. Well, the entire game is about making them feel horrible.
Yeah.
Well, they're all humans, right? Like, I mean, you can feel like one way or another about which one feels better to kill, but you're still killing people.
Yeah.
You know, it should be something. It's taking something that should be degrees of gray, and it has to be black and white, you know, binary, because it's a video game. You know, like,
well, and it's also the difference between viewing them as a faction versus viewing them as an individual. Yo, know, I didn't feel bad. You know, like I said, really fighting the 33rd. I did feel bad taking out the people after their conversation about bubblegum.
Oh yeah, gosh,
yeah.
Yeah, even though they end the conversation with "Yeah, fuck that guy,"
and that made them more human. Like,
yeah. Of course they're saying "fuck you." You've been killing all their buddies.
No, like, they didn't say "fuck you" to that guy. It was just like some other guy that you probably already killed.
Yeah.
Like, each of us has a colleague that if it was kind of like, yeah, you know, I kind of fucked this guy over. Yeah, fuck that guy, right? Like, that humanizes them more. It makes it not just kind of like, oh boy, I hope I get to make it back for all seven of my kids' birthdays. They're all on the same day. I have a truck full of balloons for them.
I'm retiring in a week.
Yeah. Like, if it was like that, it'd be kind of like, okay. But it's that little moment of bite thrown at the end. It's kind of like, oh, that's something I would say, and now you have to die.
Yeah. By the way, right after that, not to take us on a tangent, but right after that is one of my favorite pieces of dialogue from the game, and I think it's something a lot of people easily miss, because you have to successfully take out those two guys without raising the alarm, which I did the first time, and then sneak up on the like main complement of people and not immediately assault them. And it's just the commander talking about, you know, everything that's going on in this Delta Force that's taking them out. And I forget the exact line to set it up, but the commander just kind of mutters under his breath, "Forgive them. They know not what they do." And one of his soldiers then goes, "What'd you say?" And he's like, "It was nothing." And it was just this great, like, fourth wall breaking moment of, you know, spoken about Delta Force, but also spoken about these, you know, people playing these video games and glorifying mindlessly killing hundreds of people without really thinking about what they're doing.
There are several points where, like, when somebody is talking and saying something damning, they are pointing directly into the camera.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I'm real weak to that, to people talking to the player in these kind of things. I mean, Bioshock's the big classic example of that, but this game does it, you know, even more frequently. And that's something that I'm always, you know, pick up on and is really affecting to me.
So the White Phosphorus kind of breaks Walker. Like, that's when he finds the walkie-talkie and starts talking to angels, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And that's actually the next choice that you make almost immediately after that scene is the execution dilemma.
Yeah.
Where the two people are hanging. And that, honestly, just in contrast to what you just went through, didn't have that much emotional punch for me. It was like, yeah, I'm going to shoot the snipers because I'm mad at Conrad, but it wouldn't really affect me to kill one of these people.
It felt so much like it was so transparently game.
Yes.
Like, you know, I tried the third way too. Like, I shot the ropes out, you know, just because that, you know, I was looking for those kind of things. And, you know, kudos to them for putting those alternate ways out. But yeah, I just it was almost more powerful because it felt so fake and jokey, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. And I liked, I kind of felt like it made more sense once you saw the reveal at the end that that never happened.
Totally. Like, that's what, I mean, it seemed video gamey and kind of cheap, but it's because, you know, this is this weird kind of, that none of that's happening. So it's kind of the way that Walker is personifying Conrad at this point, you know, and kind of making him, like, I envision when you take that third way out, you know, that's Walker kind of pretending he's done something great when he hasn't done anything at all. Mm-hmm. You know, like it feels really fake, but it's really just psychosis. And it feels different than like the choice with Lugo later, which is like my favorite choice in the game. Like, I feel like that's the, you know, the kind of distillation of, you know, what this game can do at the end. Mm-hmm. But I agree with you. Go ahead.
Sorry. Go on.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, I agree with you, but I think that this loses a lot of impact unless you know what's that it's not real.
And it makes sense that, you know, since Conrad is now starting to fabricate, or excuse me, since Walker is now starting to fabricate Conrad, that he makes him this like cartoon villain scenario setting up mm-hmm. kind of person. And, you know, I understand that the, you know, the kill the snipers or shoot the rope kind of is Walker's way to rationalize, hey, I'm still trying to do something heroic here. I almost saw it as shooting one or the other was almost more in line with it, because then it sets up that, hey, I've externalized and there's this external force, well, external person forcing me to do one of two bad things. And so since there is someone forcing me to do this and I was given the choice of worse or worse, now I can start to rationalize the things that have happened to me up to this point.
Yep.
Did you guys have a plan B if the game hadn't let you done that?
Oh, second time through, two?
Yeah, if you had to choose.
The soldier.
Yeah, I did my second playthrough. I did the soldier.
Yeah, my plan B was the soldier.
Yeah. Again, with the whole they should know better type of deal, right?
It's kind of, because like with the water thief, it's just kind of like, oh, he was trying to save his family, whereas this other guy was either incompetent or you know, acting out of pure vengeance, or he was going full, you know, Heart of Darkness. So so that, like, that was my plan B, but I was delighted to see that they did give you the out. You know, when I shot the rope and it worked, it's kind of like, okay, cool. Although the question is raised, given, you know, the stuff that's revealed in the Saw montage at the end, why did they keep following you after you agonized over that choice about two dead people for a while?
They talked to you about it. When I played through it the second time, they Adam's actually concerned. He's like, we have to talk about what you did back there. And like, it's really well done dialogue, because it could very easily apply to any of the choices you made.
Oh, yeah.
But it makes perfect sense if it's just him, you standing in front of two corpses talking to a radio. And like, if you watch that scene knowing what you know in the end, it still plays perfectly.
Okay.
Nice.
Yeah, I picked up on that too the second time through. I think he says, you know, Walker, we really need to talk about what happened back there.
Yeah, exactly.
What's going on with you? I've never seen you like that before. That didn't make any sense. So, and you say, like, now is not the time, essentially.
You brush him off. It's really sophisticated.
Yeah. I mean, I'd have to go back and play through it again with that in mind, but still, why would they kill and die for you after you shot two corpses?
Yeah.
Well, they're invested too, man. They're moving forward for the same reason you are, except that their scapegoat isn't this like phantom. It's you.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
You know, like the same way they
that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like the thing that they can project their guilt on is walking right in front of them.
Oh, lesson learned. You know? Cool. Yeah. That makes perfect sense.
Yeah. By the way, if you shoot the rope, does the person that you shoot down survive?
I think they get up and run off. They may just collapse like a sack of bricks. I don't know, but.
Or get shot by the snipers.
Oh, yeah.
When you shoot the snipers, since there's like four of them, the other two people, or the hanging people get shot.
I was disappointed, because what I did is I queued up Lugo to take out one of the snipers, hoping I could take them all out. And, Grid, making sense, since I apparently just ordered him to shoot someone that does exist, but he just stands there.
Yeah.
Hmm.
I mean, I did my part. I really don't care what happened to them after I did what I did, so long as I got to see more of the game.
But it's all lines are blurred in Spec Ops.
None of us are saints.
Yeah.
Oh wait, that's Max Payne. Sorry.
So this kind of leads into the probably the longest chapter in the game, which is stealing water, which is all the way from kind of. Oh, go ahead.
Sorry, just one thing. We skipped whether you saved the CIA guy or not.
Oh, oh yeah. Right. That's a ways back.
That's after stealing water.
No.
No. That's before the.
Which CIA guy?
You're talking about Rick?
Gould.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
That's the first. The first major more choice. I think that's either right after or right before White Phosphorus.
I think that's apropos. No, that's after
White Phosphorus? It's right before.
That's right before. Okay, so you were already like approaching the line at that point. I mean, I think that's apropos of the discussion of like which do you side with, the CIA, the civilians, or the 33rd? Right? Who do you? Where do your sympathies lie? Like what did everybody do? I went for the civilians. And I felt like shit because every apparent consequence was that I fucked everybody over. Like the way that it framed it was because I went with the civilians, you know, Gould wasn't able to tell me what Riggs' plan was, so I followed Riggs blindly.
I had a flashbang, and I couldn't quite, just from the cutscene, and I don't know if this was intentional, I couldn't tell where they'd taken the civilians. I was under the impression that they were still in the immediate vicinity. So I flashbanged and you know, took them out, and then just searching for them, thought they were nearby, couldn't find them. And, you know, by the time it was there, it was too late. So I went with saving Gould by way of flashbang.
Hmm. Yeah, that's what I did too. I tried to have my cake and eat it. And
yeah. Oh, you're not going to get off that easy.
I actually shot my cake.
With an
icing
gun.
Have my cake
gun.
And shoot it.
Yeah. You can shoot your cake and eat it. You just have to chew slow for buckshot.
Yeah.
makes you savor it more.
Yeah.
One of the things I really liked with the characters of Lugo and Adams was the way in which they kind of played both sides, whereas Lugo always advocated for the military, and Adams always advocated for the civilians,
right?
Mm-hmm. And I kind of liked that they did. You know, you have a you have a moral choice where you have to decide whether or not to save the military guy, and Lugo gets, you know, really pissed if you don't save him. And then you have the White Phosphorus thing, where it's the decision of whether or not you hope, you know, whether or not you you don't really have a choice, but to screw over the civilians, and mm-hmm. then it's Adams that is on your case,
mm-hmm. right? I liked, you know, like aside from Walker, Lugo's transformation was one of the most like kind of fascinating to me. Like mm-hmm. the most interesting to watch, because he starts out as kind of like, oh, he's the smart aleck guy. He's probably going to get into a couple of hijinks and talk about having sex with a lady, and then maybe, you know, crack wise about, oh boy, I'm going to have to pay extra for the dry cleaning on this one, you know, after he splatters somebody's head. But like, he takes a nosedive into like real serious real quick.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Which is really underlined kind of in, I was going to go ahead, David, I was going to transition us. But I guess I was actually jumping a thing because I was going to talk about Radio Man, because that's kind of the climax of Lugo.
Yeah.
Okay. I was just going to say the other thing I found interesting about him is, you know, Lugo advocates for, you know, siding with the military and then gets killed by the civilians, whereas Adams advocates saving the civilians and then gets killed by the military.
Holy shit.
I don't
right.
know if that was intentional, but I thought that was interesting.
Yeah,
it's super interesting.
Yeah, no, that's that is a terrible symmetry.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
let's talk about water, guys.
Yeah, water for real. So I kind of felt fucked over by this part, which like leads into the whole making choices with incomplete information. So because I chose to save the civilians, they cast it as like, okay, you were helping Riggs, not knowing that his plan was to, you know, thirst everybody. What do you call it when you deprive somebody of water forever? To parch.
Desiccate.
Yeah. To parch and or desiccate the entire population of Dubai. Like, did anybody save Gould and, you know, have that turn out a different way? Was he like, yeah, man, Riggs, good, real solid guy?
Oh, he dies anyway. You can do nothing to save him.
Oh, yeah. They sandboard him.
See, I had a completely different read on this whole thing. My understanding was that it was never the intention of the CIA to get rid of all the water. They just didn't particularly care. Because
they wanted to silence everybody.
Weren't planning on getting ambushed and all the water gang destroyed.
Yeah,
that was just gone.
You're right. Like it's a plan B for him. Like they're trying to take the water to cripple them, but they still, you know, they're not necessarily trying to kill everyone. And then I feel like he says something about it when you're doing the chase on the water. I think Riggs says something like, "This is going tits up. Like there's, you know, no one's leaving with this water."
Well, yeah, and then it becomes apparent that they're cornering him, and he kind of said, "All right, well, I'm crashing the truck. No one can have it." But I think it's really interesting that as you're going in, Conrad straight up tells you what Riggs is going to do, and he's like, "Just think, Walker. The CIA is trying to silence this whole situation. They're not going to want anyone who knows what's going on. You're a fool if you think he's not just going to, you know, wind up killing everyone."
Yeah.
And like says, and I think your response is something like, fuck you, you know?
I can't reconcile what you guys are saying with their ultimate goal, which is to make sure that no word gets out and that a world war isn't started. Like, how could they have like captured the water but still kept people alive who knew what the 33rd did and still kept it silent? Like, if that was their ultimate goal, I can't see them doing anything but trying to kill everybody in that city.
I mean, you're probably right. I'm just saying that he puts on the pretenses of not.
Oh, okay.
Like, so it plays into his individual or, like, right. The actual arc of what he's doing at the time.
Okay.
You know, like, it comes off as, like, this is a plan B.
Okay.
But, you know.
And it's interesting. I almost wonder how much Riggs was, like, played the figure that Conrad did in, Afghanistan? Where was the...
It was Kabul, so it was Afghanistan.
Kabul, yeah. You know, that you know, Riggs kind of was hardened to it all. We have to do what we have to do. I'm going to get the job done. That kind of, and almost played that figure that became the leader of their group. And I felt like that Walker's relationship to Riggs was very, very similar to the relationship he had with Conrad before. And that was kind of part of the reason why he was so willing to participate.
Yeah. Because Riggs was the badass. Like, he was the person who was, like, always a couple of steps ahead of you, et cetera.
Yeah.
But, like, they're without that element of sacrifice. So you idolize Conrad because he basically carried you out of Kabul on his shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
Because you were, you know, shot through the gut or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and then you have, you know, again, going back to all the hallucinations that you start to have, you hallucinate Conrad just standing over you. And basically saying, you know, in 4 days, Dubai is going to tear itself apart.
Yeah.
And that's where I should have started questioning the whole thing, because I wondered why he didn't just kill you.
Yeah. They did that in Battlefield 3. And I think that's why I accepted it, is they had the big bad just standing over you at one point.
Right. Yeah, I guess for me it was more, I felt like Conrad, more than most villains, was really set up as the type of guy that doesn't do that, that just kills, you know, just, you know, doesn't leave loose ends, just step and kills people.
Let's talk about Conrad's motivations, because in from a purely pragmatic standpoint, you know, he said, you know, Dubai is in shambles, and you know, we're all basically damned here. You know, there's no help coming, essentially, and, you know, it's just the worst of worst situations. And I think he says in the big kind of hell tower hallucination that, you know, my job was just to keep people alive. That's all I was trying to do. And my methods were barbaric and, you know, heinous sometimes, but the ultimate goal was to keep people alive, which seems to be more than, you know, Walker cares about.
So we have to separate, you know, Conrad's motivation, actual, like, extant Conrad, now deceased,
God rest his soul,
and also whatever Walker ascribed to him, right? Mm. Because
even what Walker ascribes, there's kind of a twisted sort of logic to it. Yeah. I could understand why you would say, hey, look, you know, I'm straight up shooting anyone who steals water, but that's because we cannot have people stealing water here if we want to survive.
Yeah. I mean, like, I think it comes out either in some of the intel or some of the later cinematics where Conrad just like says, like, we tried to escape and the storm ate us alive. Yeah. We need to try and preserve life as much as possible, you know, for some kind of rescue. And you weren't the rescue that they needed or wanted.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So it was just kind of like you were there fucking everything up. You know, everything that you touched, you fucked up. And so they were responding to that. But, you know, actual Conrad saw how hopeless the situation was, told everybody, hey, stay put. We need to, like, hold out. And then the regime popped up around him and carried out what they thought to be his will, whereas he committed suicide, recognizing, like, hey, we're fucking in hell right now.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to fucking in hell, which I imagine on a blood skull lake, but yeah. You know, on some kind of gondola,
on a biker t-shirt.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. But that's the way that I read it. Like, you have to divorce those two because, you know, Conrad exists almost entirely as a construct in Walker's head.
No. This water thing is a act of violence on a scale that you haven't done at this point.
Right.
Like this is a bigger deal than the phosphorus.
Yeah.
Right. Like you're dooming tens of thousands of people.
Oh, right. Right. The end result.
Yeah. Of this water thing. And that's, I mean, you know, this is a, when Cole texted me at some point when he's playing this and he's like, well, I just, you know, just got to the phosphorus. Holy fuck. And I texted him back. I said, it gets worse. And he said, you know, worse than a mother shielding her child's eyes from, you know, white phosphorus. And you know, my comeback was like that, you know, she's not a character. She's kind of a set piece. Think about like what's happening to Walker as a character. And this has to be like a ridiculously huge, like all of the lines that you hallucinate Conrad saying that are in reference to this and all the things that the radio man chatter that comes up, like was really, really resonant with me. Like, you know, there's going to be a lot of thirsty soldiers right now coming after you. Like, cause you've killed everybody, you know, like no matter what, like everybody's dead. Yeah. Like you've helped kill everyone. Like, and you know, huge, huge disaster, huge, like war scales, like people die in the number of wars with the, you know, the action at this point, just through ignorance, you know, just through not questioning this guy's motivations. Like at some point when you're first hearing about, I think it's Gould, but when you're talking about the CIA, you say something like, we have no choice but to follow them because they're the only people not shooting at us right now.
Yeah. You know? I think that makes it worse. Like if your decisions clearly led to this happening, you could almost have this, yep, I hold myself responsible and I can, you know, commit suicide and do the world a favor or something. I don't know. But in this, like, if you wanted to try to weasel your way out of it, you could very easily start pointing fingers and saying, well, I didn't know, I was just following so-and-so and I thought and I was tricked and all this stuff. And that makes the mental torture of it worse, is that you almost want to protect yourself from the responsibility, but doing so even feels so much lower than just taking responsibility. But taking responsibility admits to something so horrible, you know,
you can't comprehend it. Right. And he does that in multiple ways. So he does it in the way that just his mind is snapping. He also does it in this kind of exit plan, because after the water thing, he starts saying, we're evacuating these people. And the characters are openly mocking him. Like, they're like, we won't survive in that desert. You're out of your mind. Like, we need, you know, Adam says, like, we need to do an evac. Like, when you find him again, there's no evacuating these people at any point. But you know, this desperate need to atone for something that you can't even look at, like something so big that it makes you insane. Mm-hmm. To think about.
Yeah.
So did you guys shoot rigs?
Yes.
Yep.
See, I ended up, although I had mixed feelings, because, you know, I don't know. I guess in terms of like my personal moral code, I don't like the idea of like euthanasia or suicide or, you know, mercy killing. But at the same time, I had no desire for him to suffer by this point. So this was actually one of the moral choices I liked a lot more, because it's something I had to think about.
Yeah.
One more person suffering would have helped anything.
This was the fulcrum in which the game had broken me. So I let him burn, and every terrible thing you can do after that at this point, I did. Like, and my first playthrough through the game, like, I was just like, I felt weirdly, like I said, I identified to this character to a you know, kind of crazy degree. Not so much that I went out and set like a hobo on fire and watched him burn, but like I was just kind of like, you know what, this asshole killed, like I didn't do it, this asshole killed all these people, let him fucking suffer, you know. Yeah. And just walked. And it's really haunting and disturbing. And then later, you know, the later scene where you get that choice, I also made the bad choice.
Yeah.
At that point, because I wanted to.
Which choice was that?
With Lugo. Like with the civilians. Oh, like yeah. I wanted to. It's ridiculous. You know,
see, and with Riggs, I shot him, but not because I wanted to give him mercy, but because I wanted to be the one to kill him. Mm. Like that was my act of atonement was, no, I'm not gonna let some truck take you out in poetic justice. I'm taking you out.
Yes. Being burned alive under a water truck.
Yeah.
Ben, what'd you do?
Irony.
The first time I just shot the bullet in the air to see what he would say, and then I didn't realize that there was like an oil fire there, and I was like, oh, well, that's kind of bad. And so I reloaded and shot him.
Oh, yeah. So. Yeah, I don't know. So I Why am I feeling the need like to defend my choice to mercy kill him?
Yeah. How could you?
Yeah. It's spec ops, man.
That's why this thing got a whole episode. Do we want to talk about Radio Man and the Tower?
Yes.
Yeah.
I fucking love Radio Man.
Yeah.
Like, am I right? In the end, he was actually probably the most overt good guy in all of this.
Probably. Like,
how did he help anyone though? He just mocked as people got killed.
Yeah, he was crazy.
Yeah.
But not actively malicious.
Actually, I really like that as a statement. Sorry, just to expand on that in a way, sure, that probably nobody intended. But how many people in the world just sit back and mock the people who are agents of evil, or mock the people who are fucking stuff up and then feel like they're good guys when really they haven't done a thing to help?
Well, me, you know, I identified with Radio Man. That's why I fucking liked him.
Yeah, but you know, interesting question that the game asked that I hadn't thought about till now is, you know, that's an easy out, sarcasm and you know, saying fuck the bad guys is feels really good, but it does, you know, ultimately that's, you know, you're still complicit.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, sorry, continue about how you like this monster. No, well,
to be fair, there is a piece of intel where like it comes up, like he has a press pass. He was like legitimately the next Hunter Thompson. And then he just kind of fell off the deep end once the storms hit.
Yeah,
he becomes a true believer. Like, there's an interview that he has with Conrad, yeah, where he like they kind of like he's recording it. Conrad doesn't want to. Conrad says some stuff that actually reaches him, and he decides not to record it. But you get the point. You get the idea that he buys, you know, we need to have this kind of civilization by hook or by crook.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
By hookers or crooks. Yeah. But but I mean, he was there. He was the organizing force, right? Like, he not only was like radio, he had like a PA to the entire city. So that's why you're hearing this music. And that's why, like, you know, he's organizing the 33rd's movements to a startling degree.
Right.
Yeah.
But then he's a Vietnam reference. You know, surrendering and pseudo helping you before taking something to the noggin.
I love that scene. Yeah. That was one of the most horrifying scenes to me, because like, hey, the old Lugo's back, and it's kind of like, oh, that wasn't the old Lugo. The old Lugo was the disguise. This is him disguising himself so that he can just get him off his guard and say like, hey, this is an awesome setup you hear, and then just two tap him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like just like that, like such a great scene, and like it came out of nowhere for me anyway. Like, I didn't expect that to happen. It's kind of like, okay, let's do that. And then just boom, boom, boom.
Here's a question for you. Did anyone other than Radio Man know that Conrad was dead? Because if he's been organizing the troops to that extent, I can't remember any place where he directly makes reference to Conrad being alive or trying to speak on Conrad's behalf. But, you know, he does seem to be running things. And I wonder if that's and you find in the refugee camp, there's like an effigy of Conrad. So the people clearly are still like looking up to him as the savior. I wonder if you could defend the position that Radio Man has been running these things. And on the opposite side of being the closest thing to a good guy is actually the true villain who's been causing all this chaos under the pretense of following orders from Conrad.
Like perpetuating the perversion of Conrad's, you know, philosophy.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I think you have to buy in that Conrad was 100% like a black villain, though. and that there isn't any truth or merit to his idea of like,
or that he just said some stuff like, we got to try to save people any way we can before he went, and Radio Man took it to a logical extreme.
Like it could be that like he did say something that made sense, and then just it was taken away.
And then since Radio Man, I like this. Oh, I like my theory here.
I don't necessarily think that the civilization quote unquote that you find in Dubai, like I'm willing to buy, and I feel like it's thematically stronger if, and kind of morally more gray if that is the best that they can do. Like I don't want to villainize anybody who's doing that. I feel like it's a compromised, shitty situation, but I buy pretty big into the theory that like this is, you know, whoever's doing it is doing it for the greater good of the most people, whether it's draconian or not.
Right.
I feel like some of this, it also depends on kind of what the player brings into it.
Go ahead.
Just in terms of like what the individual's view is on, you know, how you value, how you weigh freedom, survival, order, those different elements of society, which you value most highly. I know that was part of my reaction to it, is I would say I would value, freedom and justice, even if that means that the society falls apart. So I really didn't agree with what the 33rd was doing, but on the other hand, I could see how someone could view continuity of society as being worth sacrificing justice and freedom for.
So Radio Man was the force for order, but he was also kind of the most chaotic neutral in terms of his like personality and disposition. Right. So it's this weird split, right?
What did you guys think of when he was making the jokes about the people you were sniping?
I loved it.
Yeah.
I thought that was a good element of, where it was sort of really, depressing and shocking and stuff, but also some of them kind of funny in terms of like doing the old cliches of like, oh, this was his last day on the force, and he just showed you a picture of his girlfriend.
My fantasy football league.
Right. Like I felt like it did a really good job of kind of balancing, sort of a dark humor with, the seriousness.
Yeah. Well, it's again, that contrast or that cognitive dissonance, which they talk about in the menu screens.
I love that
between between being the player sitting on the couch and hearing some genuinely funny dialogue, and also being drawn into this horrible context that the dialogue is in.
It feels perverse is what it is. I don't know that I felt bad for laughing, because it was very much in the moment of the game, just kind of like, I'm sniping, this is probably the most fun the sniping has been right now, and also I'm being entertained, so like, I can only feel dirty in hindsight, and maybe that was the point, I don't know. So Lugo fucking busts a cap in what's his name, Radio Man, and by bust a cap I mean fires a couple of bullets straight into his head.
What else would you mean by busting a cap? You don't need to elaborate that.
Just trying to open a nerd.
No.
You don't get that slang.
Okay,
when Michael Jackson says something is bad, he does not actually dislike it.
That's the joke.
Is it?
It's not really a joke. It's just a thing. I said bust a cap, and then I was immediately self-conscious about me saying bust a cap.
So about that whole hit the ground running thing.
Yeah. No, that's... Oh, man. We just came back from a break that the listener couldn't hear. No. So you polish off Radio Man, and the airwaves go silent, and you hop into a helicopter, quote, to see what this gun can do.
Yeah, you're gone.
Yeah,
like you bring us around. I want to destroy this thing. Like you are fucked at this point. And I think that this this has a lot to do with watching Lugo break, right? So like you're not that attached to Radio Man. like when you see them kill. But the fact that it makes such a big difference here is like you just watched this person who's one of your, you know, good friends, like just degrade and seeing the same thing that Cole mentioned, where like he's tricking this person into, you know, getting into his confidence so he can shoot him. Mm-hmm. Like I read this as a direct kind of, you know, guilt for transforming Lugo.
Mm-hmm. Very fair. And I think I felt horrible at this point because bringing the chopper around and taking down the tower was exactly what I was hoping to do.
Yep.
Like I didn't know it was coming, but what I was thinking just to myself in that moment was I would take down this whole fucking building if I could.
Yeah.
And it's just, it was like the wish granted in the worst possible way.
By this point, I had forgotten about the intro sequence. So when Walker said, wait, didn't we just do this? I was kind of like, yeah, didn't we just, oh yeah. Flashback humor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I guess that kind of sets up a unreliable narrator type thing.
Well, one of the theories that I've heard is just that like Walker died in the crash and like all of this is his Jacob's Ladder dying nightmare, which that's not incredibly satisfying, but.
So we weren't
actually either is Jacob's Ladder.
Bite your tongue.
He meant the toy, Cole. He meant the toy.
Okay. Cool.
It's not that fun now. I don't know if you play with it lately.
So that's the theory of what the game would be interpreted as if it was written by M. Night Shyamalan.
Yeah, right.
I guess, or you know, the what is it? The incident at Owl Creek. Like that's a pretty old construct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's unsatisfying though, so I reject it.
Yes.
Yeah. And what purpose would that serve though? Like you've already done all the horrible things up to this point. What about the rest of the game from that point would be worth having him dream or whatever?
Maybe he did something like slightly less worse on the way up to it, and everything, you know, up to when you died was the hallucination that you had after dying, but you were kind of like working through your guilt in a bigger, badder way.
It feels like people trying to rationalize their participation in something that they knew was horrible.
Yeah. This is just something that I've heard about. I'm not really being an advocate for this viewpoint.
Yeah. Fair enough.
Yeah.
So the copter crashes
Is this when your face burns off?
Your face had burned earlier than this.
Okay.
Because that's one of the things that, I mean, it's not worth talking about too much, but the deterioration of your soul and your mind is mirrored by your body.
Right.
In this entire game. Like the monster, like the, you know, essentially like a villain in another game. Like you're a zombie. You know, like the idea of having a deformity being like a classic Hollywood marker or signifier of a villain, you know, is big in this. And you look monstrous by the end.
Ben, was it you who pointed out to me earlier that half of his face is regular, half of his face is tore up?
Yep.
And also he flips a coin.
Yeah. Flips a, I'm going to shoot this rope and we'll see if Lugo lands face up or face down.
Whoa. Which, I mean, that kind of advances you to the next part of the game there.
Yeah, a little
before
bit.
Not much happens in the interim. Like you find Adams, and Adams is nice, and you know this is fucked, and kind of continues his downward spiral. But like the, you know, kind of fighting through the yachts to get to Lugo. Like this is kind of where some of the
loved
combat
this area.
Did
this
you was, like? Do tell.
Well, just visually, like the whole, you know, boats washed up in a desert was beautiful. It's probably my second favorite set piece. We missed the first one, which was the edge, which is just that giant canyon of sand, which is I just sat and looked at that for a little. It's just regardless of anything going on in the game, that's pretty. But then just the whole, you know, marina desert type of deal going on was really cool for me to fight through.
You fight through a lot of really interesting vistas and kind of areas in this game. Like the mall is really interesting. Radio Man's Tower with all the blacklight posters and shit.
Yeah.
Like, you know, a lot of really awesome, like kind of indirect storytelling. The Aquatarium, like everything looks really neat. You are not in generic, you know, tents and hovels and,
shooting,
you know, sandstone
villages. On a diving board.
And they could have really easily said, like, and York talked about this, which is really cool. They could have really easily said, Dubai is our cool exotic location, and then just the entire thing is Dubai the level. But they work so much variance and intrigue into all the different parts of it.
Mm.
But yeah, that that eventually leads you to the refugee camp, which, what was your guys' reaction when you saw Lugo get hanged and had to make a choice there?
Well, I mean, Walker tries to save him. He, you know, he thinks that he's there in time, but he's not. I mean, I tried to walk away. I thought that was my out. Like, I didn't, my lateral thinking kung fu wasn't strong enough to find the non me lie way to get out of it. But I ended up shooting some civilians.
Can you melee at this moment?
That's what I did, is melee them, and they count that as nonviolent.
Huh. Really?
Yeah, well, I'm assuming, because if you do that, they start running away, and Adam starts shooting into the air to scare them away, so I'm assuming that's the nonviolent approach.
Yeah,
I shot in the air, and they ran away.
Like, Adams is begging your permission to kill them, which, like, he's been the advocate for the civilians up to this point. So yeah. It's kind of like, well, you were my moral compass, and now you're pointing towards the trigger. So.
Yeah, you just look at the compass, it's just spinning. You know? I shot all of them I could, as many in the face as possible at this point. Like, I was, you know, really genuinely upset at this point. Like, right. I was mad that Lugo had died. I was mad, felt weird, like saying guilt is, ascribing real emotions to something like this is always a little bit tricky, because I mean I feel them, but I always feel a little goonish,
yeah,
like saying it, but like whatever the video game equivalent of guilt, like it was making me feel real feelings, right. And obviously I wouldn't have gone and torched a hobo, but I did shoot as many of these. I'm like, you know what, you barbarians, like, killed this unarmed broken man with a broken arm who crashed in your area, like you deserve this.
Mm-hmm.
And I shot as many of them as I could, and felt weird about it afterwards too. Like I didn't feel good about it, but it was just, I'm glad that we had that break where a couple of you guys mentioned you hadn't played The Walking Dead, because I assumed you all had, and it reminded me a lot of a decision in that game that you'll know about when you guys listen to that bonus level. But there's something, I mean, it doesn't have to do with soul. This isn't a spoiler. It doesn't have to do with civilians. But there's a decision that I made that I crossed a line that I didn't think I would cross in that game, and I was just like, well, shit, this is me now,
Yeah,
I did this thing.
I think the thing those games have in common, and I think I tweeted about this while playing The Walking Dead, but it totally applies to the line, is like anyone who is under the, under the illusion that they're really just a pretty good person overall under it all, and really, like, playing these games reveals some of these just dark emotions and thoughts that I don't feel like you really get to when watching a movie or reading a book.
Yeah, or in real life, right? Like, you don't have to deal with things with this kind of gravity in real life. And it's kind of, it reminds me of the way that one of the, the purposes of art is not always to entertain, and something that, a purpose of a game can not always to be, doesn't always have to be fun, And once we can start making games where the purpose is not to be fun, but to make you feel, just to make you feel something, it's like a game as a statement, which is the same purpose, purpose as art has, to make you feel something or to get across a point, and this is, there are many, I'm far over on the line of like games, can be art for sure. But this would be one of the first things I would show people, that like this has an editorial standpoint. It makes you feel something. It's not just designed for interactive entertainment by any
means. Yeah.
You know,
see, I really like this game because normally I'm not a huge fan of the whole games as art thing, just because most of them I see just strike me as being more arty, as more just, oh, let's make this real, weird, abstract, type of thing. Whereas I feel like this is a game that, one, is a legitimately a good game, it's a good, and also it's not so much, I would say it's almost not as much art as storytelling. Or you know what I mean?
That's a tricky line. Like, your first part I can get on board with, where there's a definite delineation between something being art and something being artful or containing art. So, like, you take something that's just like a game with fantastic aesthetics or like a world of goo, and like you can make the argument that that's art, but it's not, that's also more game. Like, it's a spectrum, Yeah. I agree with that point, but I think that, like, telling a story, like a narrative, is by definition art.
Well, yeah, and I wasn't mean that to, like, say what storytelling is in art. I mean more A lot of them strike me as more almost the whole, like, it's only art if it's weird. You know, there's kind of that view of art.
Mm. And yeah, and I don't subscribe to that. Like, I think that an action movie can be artful, you know, can be art as well. You know,
I'm just saying, like, a lot of the art, more artistic games, like the Journey, stuff like that. Not so much in terms of them being bad, but I feel like they kind of subscribe to more the let's just, you know, art means there's a crap ton of symbolism and aesthetics and stuff like that.
Pretension is what you mean.
Yeah.
Pretentious.
Yeah. So. And whereas I feel like this is more art means telling a really great story.
Right. So yeah. I think the magic here, and I'm about to say something real gross, so, you know, forgive me.
The Holocaust never happened?
All the kids turn off the podcast.
Yeah.
Why do you keep wanting to put that in your mouth, Cole? I'm sorry.
Why do you keep describing those views to me? No.
Because I've been in your secret sub-basement.
Okay. So. No. So, masturbation is to intimacy as this kind of game is to experiencing something, like this heightened sense, this, you know, like it is a consequence-free way to inhabit a heightened awareness of, you know, like these choices that you have to make. It's experience, right? It's an experience engine that you can turn on and turn off at will, right? And, you know, it's just a way to kind of inhabit this and make those choices yourself without actually having to, you know, go to a counselor afterwards, right? I don't know. I feel like I lost
surprisingly
the plot there.
Apt. But. I see what you're going to there.
Yeah.
What was the poet? It was like Rami or something like that, who would write these really like gross, absurd poems, but they all had really interesting thoughts behind them.
It was Sam Raimi.
No.
Laureate of our Spider-Man.
Yes.
I would describe the third Spider-Man as pretty gross, but.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what art can be, though, right, Cole? Like vicarious experience?
Vicarious experience, exactly. or temporarily putting you into either an altered state or, you know, temporarily changing your point of view for just a moment, right?
And with Spec Ops line, as with masturbation, you want to keep some Kleenexes nearby.
Yes. I mean, I didn't mean to be gross. I just meant to use that as like a ladder straight down to the core of what I was trying to say. So
no, I forced that.
I hope that like of the many sarcastic and stupid things I say during these, that was probably the most genuine I've been.
The thing that's frustrating, and we don't need to get into the whole like games as art debate thing because we definitely don't have time for that. But like the whole idea of the interactivity detracting from that. So like if I agree with you as art being a way of vicariously experiencing the world or one of the kind of purposes of it, the interactivity adds like a new tool for that. You know, it doesn't take anything away. It doesn't mean it's less art because you can interact with it.
Right.
You can take a game like this and utilize the interaction and tie it into the themes you're exploring and the point you're trying to make.
And that's why it succeeds.
You know? Yeah, totally. Right. You know, and when it doesn't, and people keep talking about Ludo, you know, cognitive dissonance, and it's become a watchword, but it doesn't mean that it doesn't happen.
Right.
You know, just because it's oversaid doesn't mean that it's not a problem.
Right.
You know, and yeah.
So I think we're all just avoiding talking about the devastating climax to this game.
Yeah. Like the whole run up, just like when it's nighttime. So like the entire course of this game takes place over what, 2 days? I think.
That sounds about right.
Yeah, yeah. So it's nighttime. You're going to the Burj Khalifa, you know, which the tallest building in the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you're encountering kind of the last remnants of you know, Conrad's troops. You're fully in crazy mode. You've already done the hallucination battle against the mannequins in the mall.
We missed that. That part was so good. Sorry, I had no thoughts other than that part was so good.
Well, it kind of comes back here because you have these heavy enemies, right, which are like the juggernauts in Modern Warfare, right? So, you know, they're kind of boss enemies, but the just like in the mall scene when it was hallucinating and, you know, flash stepping around becoming a mannequin or not, like in this, like you get to kind of the final area of this and it's Lugo in the heavy armor saying like, "Hey, fuck you. Like you killed me." And like, this is a weird boss battle because you can win it and, you know, you kill it. But if you lose, he just comes back as a regular standard powered juggernaut.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Yeah. I only found that out by reading about it afterwards, but
I found out about it by dying after I had killed the juggernaut and then it restarting the checkpoint and I did not have the good guns I had.
Oh, yeah.
So I was quite disappointed.
I just found out that for the heavies, when they say that the sniper rifle kills anything in one hit, they mean anything, and that makes heavies much easier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that also depends on you carrying a sniper rifle in a time when you were not required to snipe.
Right. I did not at all find the sniping to be bad, but Grant, was I the only one that did this on PC?
I just don't. Okay, so Gary, you played it on PC, right?
Yep.
And then Dennis, Ben, and I played it on PS3.
Yep.
Yeah.
I thought the sniping was fine. I don't play a lot of shooters. Like, we talked about this on the last episode of WoF, but, like, I think it's far, you know, from our favorite genre.
Yeah. No, like, I just don't like sniping as a general gameplay kind of thing. So, like, I play shooters. I've liked them. I don't know that I've encountered a sniping, you know, situation that I've really, really like dug into and liked. So, like, I'm not saying like, oh man, it didn't account for the Coriolis effect in the wind. You know, they didn't do the draw and fade. But like for me, it's just kind of like I just don't like sniping. So I'm not like, sure, I'm not panning it for that. I thought that mechanically it was sound all around. Again, as somebody who, you know, is mildly into shooters, you know.
Mm. Sure.
Yeah. By the way, just on that mall scene, I didn't realize what was happening until the fight was over. And I legitimately panicked. Like, I was low on ammo anyway, and I kept on thinking I was shooting this guy and then seeing it was a mannequin and did not realize that the game was doing that to me, mm-hmm, you know, artificially. I thought I was losing my mind.
I thought that my system was glitching. I had an awesome experience. It was right after the White Phosphorus. Or no, it was right after the helicopter crash where all of my text turned into static.
Mm.
Really?
Yeah. And I thought like, oh, this is like an Eternal Darkness interface screw, you know, blah, blah, blah. But it was like a bunch of these white dots that were all over the place. And I was like, I even paused and I was like, huh, I can't find the quit button. This is weird, right? Okay, it must be the bottom one. And I turned it back on and it was like the same thing. I had to turn the system off and turn it back on again. Because something was really fucked up. And
so what you're saying, oh, sorry.
No, it's just kind of like with Dennis, kind of like, wait a minute. It's either something wrong with me or my system. It's not the game doing this to me.
So what you're saying is you gave your PS3 post-traumatic stress.
PSTD. Or PS3DD.
Or the PS3 PDP, which is the portable one. It goes with you everywhere. PTS3DP. There we go. Oh, man. We tortured that.
Yeah.
That's just a little aside. Adam's Last Stand is something else because it's the whole Boba Fett thing. You didn't see the body, so you don't know that he's dead. Judging by the fact that you get out alive, he took out the rest of the 33rd, leaving only, I believe, 12 of them left.
Something like that.
How many people are in a unit that big? Like, does anyone know in real life, like, how many people you killed in this game?
No.
To leave 12 behind?
It's a battalion, right?
Yeah.
I'm going to Google that real quick. Keep talking.
Do that, please. Yeah. He said that there are, I know during the Hell Tower sequence or whatever, he says there were 5,000 people alive and well in Dubai when you showed up. So that doesn't account for civilians.
It does account for civilians. I was about to say something erroneous.
Battalion deaths doesn't account for civilians.
Right.
A battalion is between 300 and 1,500 men.
Okay.
So.
Which feels about on the order of magnitude of the number of people that you kill. So.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Man, we're being real clinical about this. But yeah, that there's 12 left and they fucking salute you in your mind, Tyler Durden, is a big deal.
Yeah.
Well, and even then, were they there? Because if you remember, did you guys play the ending where you killed quote unquote Conrad and see that part?
Yeah. What endings did you guys do?
I killed myself.
I killed Conrad. At this point, like I said, I drank the Kool-Aid on this game. Like, I'm pretty big, the flavor aid.
Yeah.
See, so, like I said, my take on the game was that it was Conrad's fault, so I killed him.
I wanted to wait to see if you'd shoot me, and he shot me.
Same thing.
Yeah. Did you guys watch the rest of the endings?
I did, but I don't know how they're triggered.
It's basically the setting is you get one ending if you let him kill you, and then if you don't let him kill you, the three options are either surrender to the people that try to rescue you, attack them and get killed, or attack them and wipe them out.
Right.
And how do you trigger the one where you either attack them and die or take them out?
Basically, there's a cutscene and they come up, say, "Hey, we found you. You know, you're safe now, but we need you to put your weapon down." And there's a button that if you press it, you put your weapon down, or you can just start shooting.
Right. Okay. Just in retrospect, I felt like the letting Conrad shoot me was the most legitimate ending just for me. But I really liked the kind of starting where you finish or the not closure. If you survived and then attacked them and got killed, you were killed by the people who were supposed to be coming to rescue you, like you did to everyone else in Dubai. Yeah. And I played that, you know, just went back and did that ending sequence a couple times and was like, huh, that's really poetic in a dark way.
Yeah.
By
this point, unlike Gary, I didn't have rock hard bloodlust. Like something that Conrad said just really spoke to me. There was a line that just kind of like, you know, just like that, like it wasn't where I broke long before that, but you know, it just kind of like made me internalize the guilt and just be like, okay, yeah, I should probably die because of this, which was, you came here to be something that you're not, a hero, right? Mm-hmm. And just kind of like, mm-hmm. I you know, on one, like one part of me was like, okay, I need to let him shoot me because I want to see if there's something weird. The game wants me to shoot him. But another part was kind of like, okay, so if he shoots me, I get what I deserve. Right? So I was submitting to that guilt.
Yeah. And clearly, yes, both the player and you. Like, right, you're playing the game because, and that's why we play those kind of games. Mm-hmm. Because we want to feel like something we're not. You know,
Oh,
sorry. I feel like I'm the psychopath here because I'm the only one who apparently felt that truly it was Conrad's or the 33rd's or whatever's fault. And so I shot him because he says, if you think it's my fault, shoot me.
Even after he makes it clear that it's a figment of you?
Well, I still feel like other than the... I still feel like the decisions I made, like I said, were the best decisions of the options I was given.
Mm-hmm. My motivation in not shooting him, I think, was, and I, again, knowing he's a figment in my mind, but I'm not going to pull the trigger. You know, I've done enough pulling the trigger through this entire game. I've seen that it's all been my fault, as it were. I refuse to pull the trigger even one more time, which ultimately, of course, ended me pulling the trigger on myself in one way or another, but that was my rationale, less so than I deserve to die.
Two details I liked. One, the closing dialogue to that particular scene. If you let him shoot you, the closing dialogue is, you know, that you end it with, you know, some, you know, no, there's no survivors. Whereas if you shoot them, you end it with there's a number of survivors, one too many.
Right. If he kills you, then the ending audio snippet is the same audio snippet from the beginning.
It's
the distress beacon that brought you there in the first place.
And then the other thing I like is, I don't know if you look at the, if you all the scenarios where you ultimately meet the other rescue team, you're wearing Conrad's uniform.
Right.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, the ending audio snippet is the same as the beginning audio snippet. Also, it's Conrad reading a letter from his dead wife.
Hmm.
Wait, what?
Really?
What? No, no, I'm... God,
killing
that,
me.
That was like seven steps off of being...
Yeah, it went right over my head.
Oh, man.
Although there is that creepy-esque poem to his wife, which...
Yeah.
No, the one that got me was the letter to his son. Oh my God, I only found that the second time around. I about burst into tears. Mm-hmm. Did you guys see that?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
It just reads, son, one day people will tell you about me. Mm-hmm. And for that, I'm sorry. I love you.
Oh, shit.
Dad.
Yeah, that's...
And I was just like, oh my God.
Mm-hmm.
So that's Spec Ops. We're kind of drawing up on this being one of the longest shows we've ever done.
Yeah, thanks for sticking with us, especially if this is your first time listening. They're not all like this. Unless you really liked it, in which case they're all like this.
Yes, every single one, except for the majority, which are the exception. but like, kind of, do we have any final remarks on how this game kind of like has stuck with us? You know, I'm just kind of like final thoughts on, you know, just general holistic. Let's have a drum circle, guys.
I was really happy to have an interview with Jörg just to get kind of an inside perspective. Cause I think perhaps one thing we might lack in knowledge is kind of the inside logistics of how these games get made. So I think it was really interesting to hear about that perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, mm-hmm. so great to have him on the show.
Definitely. Gary.
No, I mean, this is one of those, like, there aren't that many games that I can say that I feel real feelings about. You know, I say it on WAF all the time. Like, I'm not one of those people who like cried when Aerith died. Like, you know, I understand the emotional beat of those kind of moments, but to actually, you know, something that kind of recontextualizes and, you know, other games and the way that we play games. And I called you out on in this episode of Watch Out for Fireballs, where you start kind of bad-mouthing Max Payne for shooting. And, like, I can tell it's because you just played this game.
Yeah.
Like, having that kind of impact is a real rare thing. And I think that if you... You know, people, I mean, we obviously think it's a good game. We did this whole show about it. But if you have any interest in, like, what games can be as you know, as an artistic statement, like, I think that you kind of owe it to yourself to check this out. You know,
if you're listening at this point and you haven't already, what the hell, man?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. You're totally good point. Everyone has it. Tell your friends to, though, and sell them on it in that way that, like, this is, you know, kind of like a different thing for games to be and rare and it needs to be supported. You know, because I don't want all games to be like this, but I want some of them to be like this.
Yeah.
And, you know, this should be encouraged.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Again, media that you consume in proximity to each other, that, you know, there are a certain number of things that you watch or read or play that just kind of like it'll get better on repeat viewings, of course, but just as you get more distance from them. So like this past weekend, you know, I've been real talk here. I've been really, really fucking depressed since my car accident.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's been terrible for me to, you know, drive in a car. You know, I've just been, you know, just kind of like going through and, you know, kind of trying to deal with that, right? And I've, you know, this past weekend I was in a real low point, and I watched Synecdoche, New York, right?
Good idea.
Yeah.
Did you listen to some Elliott Smith while you did that too?
But just kind of like, I liken it to that. And, you know, just kind of like one of those things that recontextualizes and kind of bends time and space around your own personal kind of geography that, you know, it's incredibly valuable, I think. I don't know where I was going with that. But I guess I wanted to get to the Ben's time and space because that's real cool.
I totally agree with that.
I'll just say that it's made me kind of expect more from the medium and start saying, okay, where can I get other, not experiences like this, but experiences that have this level of consideration and intentionality and actively start seeking those games out.
Yeah,
that's rare, man. Like there aren't that. Like I've you know, like when I follow stuff about this game and people are like, what other games do this kind of stuff? Like, this is great. And it's really divisive. Like, not everybody on the message boards loves this stuff. Like, some people, you know, are really kind of furious at it. And some people are just like, it's not very fun to shoot people in it, you know. But that comes up a lot. Like, what games are like this? What kind of games do this? And I think they're really rare, you know. And if you start expecting that level of things from games, like, you're going to end up not playing games anymore. Cause it's, you know, you have to get excited about B plus stuff, you know, and this game kind of stretches you out for that.
For sure. Mm-hmm.
I think for me, what I really enjoyed about this game is, I like the way it let the more choices be open enough to let me, you know, kind of bring my, you know, what I wanted to do, stuff like that, to the game in terms of, you know, I tend to be, fairly, fairly, go out, get it kind of interventionist in my morality or whatever. And I like that kind of shows the dark side of that in terms of, you know, trying to do the right thing, is maybe a good idea, but doing it without, like, kind of like you said, doing it without all the information can cause problems.
Mm.
So I felt like it did a good job of drawing in legitimate moral decisions, but then also showing some of the dark side of making good moral decisions,
all
if
of
that
the
makes
dark
sense.
Side.
Yeah.
Every side of the thing, all of which are dark.
Yeah.
So it kind of sounds like we've set our piece. You know, like Gary said, this game obviously means a lot to us. We felt the need to, you know, rope in one of the people who made it and then, you know, say all these things. We'd like to hear what you think, you know, just we'll probably, you know, it might be cool to do a follow up maybe in one of the multiplayer or kind of like we'll figure out what it is. But if you have any kind of like thoughts or things about, you know, things about Spec Ops, we'd definitely like to hear them. Are you guys fine with us kind of taking it to the close?
Yeah, let's do it.
Ben, can I button this up?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, cool.
Thanks for asking me.
So that was a very special bonus level about Spec Ops The Line. Thank you so much, like we said, again, for listening. I don't know why I need to repeat that. If this is your first time listening, check out the rest of the shows. You know, we like to think that they're a little bit evergreen. We do talk about video game news, but we do it from an outsider perspective. None of us have press passes or, you know, kind of inside insight, which means that we are completely ignorant, and therefore our opinion is worth more that way. No, it
more
is.
More entertaining, at least.
Yes, we're just like you. To a certain extent. We just have access to microphones. There are a couple things you can do to get more involved if this is your flavor, if you've been involved and, you know, things like that. I would like to actually thank some people who responded or who offered, you know, questions for us kind of at the last minute on the interview with Jorg. Let me see here. Specifically, Jeffrey Lawton, Mr. Geo Law himself, Alex Castano, and then Murph Murphy. They kind of offered some questions that informed what we asked Jorg, what we talked to him about. So for that, we're very, very grateful. You can see stuff like that, prompts and things, on the Facebook group, which is facebook.com/TheLevelPodcast. And you can also follow the DuckFeed Twitter, which is DuckFeed TV, or at DuckFeed TV, rather. The Level is at, duckfeed.tv/TheLevel. And you can find all of our episodes there, including our iTunes, you know, leave ratings, leave reviews. All of that's very helpful. It finds, you know, helps people find the show. It's very important to us. If you'd like to support the show or the network monetarily, you can go to duckfeed.tv/tipjar, where you can buy things on Amazon, maybe Spec Ops The Line for a friend.
or an enemy.
Yes. Here, have this little bundle of sadness. And we get a little cut from that. It doesn't cost you anything extra. And it helps support things like, you know, bandwidth, server costs, etc. additionally, you know, there are some other shows on the network that we'd like to call attention to. If you like this kind of game club format, Gary and I do a show called Watch Out for Fireballs that's about old retro video games. It's a lot of fun. We pick a game every show and then kind of do a deep dive on it. We're also doing an ongoing series called Bonfireside Chat, which is about the Souls series of games. Right now we're kind of wrapping up Dark Souls, and then we're going to be moving into Demon's Souls here real soon. Yeah. So is there anything that I'm missing, fellas?
No. Thanks again. I'm sure this episode is going to be really long, and hopefully you guys enjoyed every second of it. I know yeah. We enjoyed talking about it.
Yeah. So let's do the usual sign-off roundtable of Twitters and such. I'm Cole Ross. That's KOLEROSS on Twitter.
I am Dennis Furia, which is at DFuria on Twitter. DFURIA.
I'm David Moneysmith, which is at Moneysmith777, also on Twitter.
I'm at WOFF Podcast, WOFF Podcast, tying into that aforementioned podcast that Cole aforementioned.
And his name is Gary.
Yes.
And my name is Gary.
Yes. His name is WOFF Podcast.
And Ben. And my name is Ben Merkel at Merkelizer.
Yeah, so thank you so much for listening. We assure you, you're still a good person. Eat the leg. And then is it usual intro order with Gary at the end? Or, Ben, do you want to be last because you're traditionally last?
Sorry, I'm eating. it doesn't matter.
Okay.
No, Ben, it matters to me. Ben must be last.
Okay.
Okay. Okay, Dennis.
Sorry, Gary.